Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Morelia Python Radio, brought to you by Morelia Python Forums, www.moreliapythons.com. And we are proud sponsors of ICAST. That's August 2nd, 3rd, and 4th in Maryland, the International Collective Arboreal Symposium. Pre-registration closes on July 24th, so be sure to go over to www.arboreal symposium and register so you can attend the Morelia event of the year. Tonight we have Jason Hood on, and we're going to be talking blackhead pythons, womas, and a couple other unique species that he keeps. But this is the rebroadcast of the mishap that we had a little while ago. So we're looking forward to talking to Jason.
Very much. And we had that. We had the kind of like a pseudo second round table dealy that day, and that was cool too. So
we're thinking about having a round three, and for all those people that and we're gonna talk about morphs and all the controversy at the current time that's surrounding morphs.
Apparently,
this is what I have to say to those people, Owen.
Go ahead.
Don't worry.
Every little thing's gonna be alright.
With my crazy Frankenstein snakes.
Well, You and I talked about that whole thing that just kind of blew up on the pick of the week over the morph issue, and I am honest to God freaking flabbergasted that it got to that point. Who the fuck cares? Why are we even having this as a conversation? Okay, you don't like morphs. Good for you. Go the fuck over there and shut up. I am perfectly fine with you making your own decisions. It's when you try to enforce those decisions on the pick of the week. If you've got a problem, you take an MP. It's called the Octagon. It's where you go and you have discussions like this. You don't do it on Morelia Pick of the Week. That's for showing off pictures. Now, be respectful of the pick of the week, or I swear to Christ, we'll take it away. So,
wow, Owen, you're fired up. You know,
goddamn right I am.
I'm saving that passion for the round table, but
in the news forum,
me and Zach Baez, Darkside Exotics, went to Owen's house to see some super caramels and some nice tigers. Suddenly, felt a thump on the back of my head, and everything went black. I wake up in the back of a car, showing up to a place, and I have a big hood over top of my head. I'm led down some steps, and then all of a sudden, the hood is removed, and I'm standing in front of a door that says Site B.
The fabled Site B.
The Site B. It does exist. It's not like a unicorn. It does exist. Yeah, so we got to go over and check out some of the cool things that you got over there at Site B, you and Chris are working on. And again, I say this all the time. I preach this. You know, you can't really get a full appreciation of a species until you've
right.
seen it in person.
Until you
have looked at it and observed it and watched its motions, the iridescence on its scales, white-lipped pythons, I got to be honest, not that they weren't cool, but I
right.
never really appreciated their full potential, I guess, if you will, for the species. But beautiful. Oh, and of course, me being the Morelia nut that I am, I was in heaven with all the different scrubs that you guys got.
Yeah, you were attached to our Jaya boy, Ray.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the second Ray came out, you were like, "Duh!" So
I'm not worthy.
Yeah,
exactly.
Ray kind of does that to a room, but
yeah.
It was definitely very cool. And of course, the big thing, what I absolutely love, is you're surrounded by scrubs and white lips, and where do you go? You attach yourself to the only snake in the room that doesn't belong to Rogue, the hypobermes python over in the corner. You're like, it's so beautiful. Like, what are you doing?
Well, Burmese will always have a special
I know,
place
I know. It's,
no.
it's, your,
no.
it's your soft spot, but it was like, you're like, look at all the, what is that? It's like, Berm.
I've never seen a hypoberm in person when I was in the berm, there was like maybe four morphs. I think there was Labyrinth, Granite,
yeah.
Albino, and Green. And
right.
I was quite content with those. And now they have
now
the
everything.
Pearl and Hypo, and of course you can't keep them.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course you can't do that. So. Yeah, it was a nice little trip over. You got to see the Moluccans and, like you said, the olives and the white lips. You got to, you and Zach even got to hold some of the black phase, and then I showed you some of the gold phases over there. You got to see the monster golds that we got. So, yeah, it's a protective trip. So
yeah, that was cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there is a Site B. It does exist, and there is a person named Chris.
Yeah.
So,
I enjoy talking to Chris. Chris is he's the type of guy that he has the passion for scrubs. He's definitely jazzed about them, and I mean, he nerds out, and I always like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So
the undertaking that he has taken, because we figured out, we redid the entire White Lip project this summer, and I pretty much told him, here are the thing. Here is everything. Make it happen. And he's taken that to heart. For those of you who haven't seen the thread going on over on NP that he started about the questions that arise from breeding white lips, I think it's like 4 pages long now. And we got people weighing in on it from all over. And it's a wealth of information, so much so that it's just kind of, it's given us way more ideas than we ever thought possible. And hopefully between us, Ryan Young, and I believe somebody else in New York named Matt, Chris is probably going to call me and yell at me later, but that's potentially four, five breedings of blackface. So
wow,
who knows?
Okay.
Maybe we can try to crack this trail.
You know, and again, I'm going to go off on a little bit, not a little bit of a
go
tangent.
Ahead.
I don't want to take up too much time, but again, you know, the whole morph thing and everything is
yeah.
what it is. And I don't know if it's unfortunate or not unfortunate, but I mean, that's what herpetoculture is today. It's up to people like yourself and Chris, who are taking upon a project, white lip pythons that nobody's really working with. And
yeah.
you know, I know you guys like the Scrubs and all, but to me, when I hear you guys talk about White Lips, you get that little twinkle in your eye, Owen, like that little.
They're just you know? So damn cool, and
but
you never see them. And I love it. Like, it, all right, listen, I absolutely love my carbon pythons. I absolutely love imparting knowledge onto people who have no idea what I'm talking about with the carbon python. The White Lips are some of the only ones that I can impart that knowledge to somebody like you, who is not a novice when it comes to snakes. I tell you about the White Lips, it's something brand new. You've heard of it, but you've never experienced it. You've seen pictures of it, you've never seen it in person. I showed you my gold male Dash yesterday, and you saw the color coming off him and the iridescence, and that they are a fantastic animal. And I believe very underappreciated just because they're, you know, just harder to breed. You can't breed them. You can't make the money off of them. So why not? I absolutely love them.
Yeah.
So
I would agree. But, you know, I mean, it's you know, I think it's doing morph projects and getting people into reptiles just to begin with that are you're able
right.
to focus on. Projects like that, you know, and to be honest with you, who really cares if it even is a morph of White Lips, because they're perfect just the way they are. I mean, and there's a lot of
yeah.
there's a lot of snakes like that, but you know, I mean, I don't want to go, you know, keep going on to it, but we have Jason, he's on the line, but one more thing I wanted to just give a quick shout out before we bring him on is in case anybody missed it, our good friend Nick Mutton, he has his own radio show over on the Herp Nation radio page. He talked to Mark Spataro this past week. And I'm sorry, I forget the name, but he talked about crocodiles, which was kind of cool. And, yeah,
he's
really cool. They talked about ICAST and everything there that is going to go on, and you know, and about Mark's Boland's eggs that he got this season, and you know, it was pretty interesting. And Nick just takes things to a whole new level. Super smart guy, and you know, he's asking questions that are crazy. You know what I mean? Because he just has that knowledge. And yeah, it was really interesting, really good show. So I put a link over up on the Facebook page. You can trace that over. You can go to herpnation.com and. Go on their media page and you can search and you'll see it. The Nick Mutton Show. Check it out. I don't know anybody that knows more about pythons. I mean,
see, having Nick Mutton and Mark Spataro talk to each other has got to be like, you know, an encyclopedia battling a thesaurus. I mean, it's like, dear Lord.
Yeah.
The information
exactly.
is just over freaking whelming. I mean, I get this is one of those things I'm going to have to, like, my phone's going to be on record the entire time we're at the symposium just because I'm going to not be able to hear everything, get everything, absorb everything. So it's going to record it and play it back later. So,
yeah. Yeah, there's going to be a lot.
We're so close, dude. We're so freaking
yeah, it's
close.
Only,
I can't freaking wait.
It's a few away. So, definitely something to check out. But let me click him over here. We'll get
Jason on.
Yeah. Get this going. Talk some blackheads. Hey, Jason,
sweet.
Welcome to Morelia Python Radio. Glad to have you.
Hey, yeah. guys. Thanks for having me on.
Hey. Yeah, no problem.
Yeah. Awesome. Our pleasure. Our pleasure. Jason, normally what we do when we get into the show is we try to get a little bit of background on everybody. So we got to ask the original question is of what got you into reptiles?
Oh, man, I grew up in Florida. And run around catching anoles off the backyard, off the trees and everything, and finding the first couple curly-tailed lizards down more West Palm and Southwest, Southeast Florida, and, you know, finding out the difference between a green anole and a night anole when you're 5 years old is a pretty interesting thing to figure out there all by yourself. You know,
right.
We'd always just, you know, let them clip onto our earlobes and or your fingers or something. And I grabbed a, I don't know, 12 or 14 inch night anole, let it chomp on my finger, and I was bleeding like crazy. And then, but besides that, my first memory is I mean, I've just always been kind of a nerd and mm-hmm. really getting into stuff I find interest in. So I learned all the local snakes from a book, and my mom, we went to visit my mom's friend's house, and the gardener was telling us, you know, be careful, someone killed a coral snake out here in the yard. So, of course, I started looking through the bushes for a snake and I found a corn. And my mom's never been a hitter. She never, she threatened the crap out of us with every wooden spoon and hairbrush in the house. She never really hit us for anything.
Uh-huh.
She, went into this speed slap thing because I'm holding a corn snake, and I just couldn't figure out what she was doing. She thought it was a coral snake, and she's trying to get me to let it go, which I'm thinking, I'm like, Mom, you're hitting me. This is making me grab it harder. It's going to bite me. I don't get what you're doing. And at that point, I was just to fight her on it. And I've always been stubborn as hell, so just to fight her on the fact it was harmless, and why are you doing this? And she eventually just kept hitting me until I did drop it just to get her to quit. But
Jesus Christ.
That was like the spark, man. I couldn't not think about snakes after that.
Wow. God, you know, it says something to you that they're like, there might be coral snakes around here. Like, I'm going to go find something. It's like, oh, wait a minute. Jeez.
I was a smart kid, just not a bright kid.
That's fine. It's okay.
At least, I fished most of my life going out looking at gators, and I had a stepbrother who was 100% redneck, who'd just come back with all sorts of stuff. I mean, half the time he'd come back with something that he was going to try to throw in the grill or something, but I'd at least get to see rattlesnakes and stuff, and that really got me interested in things. And he actually brought home berms back in the 80s.
Awesome. So,
he was coming out of Loxahatchee with berms. And so people were like, oh, the berms just got there in the 90s. Like, no, he was – the right rednecks were finding them back in the 80s.
Cool.
I was just getting prepared to listen to you guys, and I feel like almost as bad now. I was listening to the set talk to you guys. That was that's a heck of a podcast.
It's okay. I can't even listen to us in later episodes because I don't listen to the episodes. I hate the way my voice sounds. So it's okay.
Oh, that's good.
I know. I can't listen. I can't. Anyway, so what brought you to Aspidites as opposed to some of the other stuff?
It's, I think like everybody, you see stuff. Something grabs your attention at some point, and you just got to go for it till you can get it, whether it's an albino corn snake or whatever it is, and just some of the old shows, just seeing the blackheads and a couple pictures and books and the glossy blackhead, and you just start really, man, I gotta get a better look at that, and I got a nice tax return at the same time someone was getting ready to try to get rid of something cheap, and I jumped on that, then I had a female and no males. Next year, he's like, hey, did your tax returns yet? I need to move another male. I need to move a pair. So there's no way I could ever afford a blackhead out of pocket. I had to not do anything with my tax return other than just drop it all on a single snake and hope for the best.
Jeez.
But, the first time I went over to pick up the first snake, she was a 9-foot female that unknown lineage, and it was at the guy's venomous display up here, and we walk in the room where he had the snake, and that was all locked down, so it was the most secure place that he had there, because it is open to the public, and if you're not in there with somebody, you can't get the venomous, so it's all locked
right.
down, it's all protected. So you go in there, and I didn't even think about it at the time, but he pulls out this 9-foot snake, and I'm just, like every snake geek seeing the first time they ever get to see their favorite specimen in person, I'm just like in awe of this thing, and she's crawling over my hands and my arms, and she kind of comes up in front of me, I got my arms out in front, and she comes up and she kind of looks me right in the face, and the guy who owned her got kind of nervous, and he's like, I'm like, what? No, she's fine. It's a blackhead. Of course, I've read everything on blackheads. Blackheads are just sweethearts, and they're, recommended first snake in Australia, and they don't bite people. So I just kind of pushed her over to the side, and she kind of crawled over my shoulder towards my back. And I had a friend of mine there with me that, while being a very large, impressive, kind of scary-looking black guy, he's just completely gay. And I expected him to help me out if there were ever a problem, but I'm glad there was never really a real serious problem, because all of a sudden I hear from behind me, "Oh, my God." And I'm like, "What?" And then I feel something just like, it felt like, you know, if you ever pissed off your parents and they grab you by the back of the neck and drag you out of the store, it felt like that. Just somebody just a hand grabbing me. And she just chomped on the back of my neck.
Oh.
I had a silver herringbone chain necklace. She snapped that in her jaws. And I guess she was just sitting in this venomous room with cobras and rattlesnakes, and it was like going to an Indian buffet tour or something. It was just all smelling spicy. So she's chewing on the back of my neck. I'm telling the guy, you know, get some alcohol, get her off. He's like, no, we'll clean you up afterwards. And we're just not communicating. And like 5 minutes later, we get her off. And I'm like, yeah, here, absolutely. Here's the money. This is awesome. I got to take her home.
I need this animal.
But yeah, my gigantic, I mean, he's 6'4". Like at the time if he hears it, he's probably going to kick my ass. He's like, I'm not that fat. But he's probably at that time, he was like 250 or something. Maybe 6'2", but he's just a big, bald, scary-looking dude, and he ran across the room the other way. Dude, what's he doing to me?
No one helped. Okay. Jeez, that's awesome. So, what is your collection like now? What does it all entail?
For blackheads, I just have that female. I brought her out to an educational show. I got eggs out of her after I got the mail. Then I brought her to an educational show we do up here with the Chicago Ecological Society every year called Reptile Fest. And
that's
cool. She was actually in the bottom of a cooler of a whole bunch of snakes, and she got smothered. It was not in the building, and I didn't even think about it, but she got smothered in the bottom of the bag. I got home and pulled her out, and I was trying to do mouth and mouth there on the floor of the bathroom, just like in tears. It was devastating. But I got three babies from her I held back.
Mm-hmm.
And then another pair of unrelated animals that came from Split Rock Reptiles. That's who I've been breeding the last few years, and they're producing amazing babies. But I'm going to cross some of the 2009s back to the Split Rock Reptile line next year. Outside of blackheads, I have just a pair of carpets, a handful of womas. One of my other favorite species of workers right now is something called Tustes, which are like Spilotes, the tiger rats.
Cousin species.
And cool. No one's working in this country. They're just completely underappreciated. One of the more variable snakes on the planet, and no one has. I have Tustes sulfurus, which is one of the longest colubrids in the world. They're supposed to get up to 14 feet long.
Jesus.
And they're basically, they're a tiger rat of a different genus, basically. I mean, they're almost all the same. They puff up. They're incredibly arboreal. They're day active. They watch your every move. They're just awesome. And some of the fastest eating snakes I've ever seen in my life, too. And then I have Tustes bacillonotus, which is, if sulfurus is the black rat of South America, then the bacillonotus would be the corn snake. They just come in a bajillion colors. They come in reds, oranges, yellows, purples. Some greens, blacks, browns, tans. I mean, just every color you can think of. And you don't know what every will look like from babies to adults. So I'm super excited about those, because just there's nothing for – they're kind of like Amazons. You don't know what you're going to get out of a pair. Amazon Trebos, that is. You know what you're going to get out of a pair of them. But what's worse is they all look exactly the same when they're born, and you have to raise them up for 2 years before you ever see their adult colors.
Oh, that sucks.
I have a pair here from that I bought from Black Pearl Reptiles. I know what it was. If you look up Tustes, you'll see it, and there's the Central American animals that are extremely diverse in all these different colors, particularly in Costa Rica. Then you got South American animals, which is what, like Bartlett, wrote about back in Corn Snakes and Other Rat Snakes, where he said they're just kind of like the uglier, meaner little cousin of the tiger rats. And down there they are. They're like brown with a yellow chin, and that's really it. And it
really
seems like they all go into this phase at about a year old where they all go brownish, brownish, orangish, yellowish, whatever their adult colors are going to be. There's a hint of it, but not much. And they just look horrible. I mean, they're just like this blah-colored snake, really nondescript and just not really exciting looking. And I bought this pair from Black Pearl when they were in that phase. I think they just got them up that size, and I'm like, oh, crap, this sucks. Get rid of them. So I grabbed them, and they are just stunning. They're absolutely amazing now. I get people who just off me anything for them, and there's no way I'll ever get rid of them either. They're just really cool animals. But anyways, I also have Amazons and then a couple of milk snakes, I think. I think they would cover all of it. Oh, and Sambo
cool.
as well.
Jeez, just kept going there.
That's cool. That's quite a diverse collection. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, I love the tiger rats. I've seen pictures of
those.
So.
How
tiger rats are awesome.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask you, how do you, you know, like a lot of people will set up a collection based on similar keeping. Do you keep everything kind of the same, or is all these different species kept different? How do you do that?
Well, Amazons need more humidity, obviously, than blackheads and stuff. I have it's a mishmash collection, the mishmash of cages. I've got some 20-inch cube Exoterras. I've got 6-foot Visions. I got Neos, the old slant back Neos that are older than me, actually. I get all sorts of stuff. You know, I little here, little there. I got a couple racks. So I kind of get the cage for the animal and work with it. And that's, you know, that's a big thing I think that people need to think more about in this hobby, especially when trying to dole out advice to anybody, is it doesn't matter what you're keeping to a point, because everything can be kept with the basic information we have about stuff. You can keep everything in multiple ways. And I have force-blown air for my heat here, which I don't know if you guys, I don't know where you're at in the country, but we're up in Chicago, and when it gets super cold and the heat's going constant, there is absolutely no humidity in this building at all. Like, there's zero. But
right.
I can go down the street and people have radiated heat. And that just, you can kick up a ton of humidity with radiated heat. So just between those two things, you can get vastly different answers to what you need to do to solve your problems for keeping. So I think when people start giving out advice on how to set something up, it's got to be a lot more broad than people want to do. If you want to answer what's wrong with my setup, then that's a different question. But if you do want to say, how do you set something up? Well, what do you have for a house? How do you heat your house? How do you cool your house? What's your average temperature?
Right.
There's so much
what
more
are you
going
looking
on
at?
There.
Yeah.
Yeah. Guess when I look at it, I look at like I basically have a base temperature of about 80 degrees in my room, and then you know I heat the cages from there. But because I'm keeping all pythons, they really fall into the same type of keeping. But you know, if I were to have say, you know, I don't know, colubrids or something in my room, I may have to tweak that a bit. You know what I mean? So that's the...
Well, didn't you guys have Terry on from Black Hills?
Yeah.
He was talking about everything, absolutely everything at 80 or 82 degrees.
Yeah, he was telling us that.
Yeah, so I mean, how is that for completely different than what most of the rest of the community does?
Very, very different.
At the end of the day.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, if it works, it works. That's the important thing. And
sure.
If you can get the I mean, snakes want to reproduce. If they're not reproducing, you're screwing something up, with the exception of like bolens that are, there's a missing link there somewhere for almost everybody except for Mark. If you have a snake and it's not reproducing, you're screwing up bad.
Yeah.
That's
right.
What they want to do. That's their end goal, even reproduce once a year or twice a year.
Right.
So, I mean, for us as keepers, it should be easy.
It's about watching your snake and paying attention to what they want. So
Well, everybody says go out and get a heat gun. That's great if you know exactly what you're doing for your and you have a huge collection. If you're somebody that has just wall upon wall of racks and you need a heat gun, okay, great. If you've got cages, I didn't have a heat gun for the first 10 or 15 years I was keeping snakes.
Because
I'd walk in, if all the snakes were away from the heat, okay, it's too hot. It's not hard to figure out. I mean, you can just walk in. Your snake should be somewhere near the heat, but not on it. If they're on it, then you got problems. It's too cold.
Right.
Unless you just fit. But
okay.
I don't know. People are getting the whole idea of a care sheet mentality in the hobby is just kind of dumbing down the hobby a bit.
Sure.
Yeah,
I can see your point with that. That people don't think anymore. They think it becomes just a recipe and they follow it and they're going to have success, you know. What is it about blackheads in particular that you like about the species? Like what, you know, what excites you about them?
I think the same thing as everybody else. They're just awesome looking. They're as far as captives go, they have a whole range. I've got in my captives don't read the books either because I have a female who when she's in her rack right now because she had a weird skin thing going on. But when she's in her 6-foot vision, I have to cover the whole front of her vision or she'll sit there and just cage strike nonstop.
That's
like, lovely. Blackheads don't do that. Like, no, she does. But they're even when she's pissed off and she's doing that, as long as she's not hurting herself, it's adorable to watch because they sit there and they like chew while they're hissing at you. It looks like they're talking to you. And then they're, you know, she does her strikes and then they don't bite. Even if like when I'm in there and she starts doing that while I'm in the cage cleaning or doing her water or something, if she hits me and she draws blood, it's because she was in mid chew trying to like yell at me while she was hitting me. And she'll drag a tooth across me, but they don't actually bite.
Okay.
Huh.
Never actually gotten bit by any of them.
Really? That's interesting.
Well, except for the first one that was a super
that grabbed your neck. Right? how do you approach, like, what are the basic requirements that you're looking for your, do you keep your, like, give them a hotter hot spot or because of where they're from or how are you approaching that?
My adults, I have them set up in either, well, I have my adults and my young adults, things that are under 7 feet long and not, and under the size of a soda can, or I have some that are right about 7, but they're still, you know, long little noodles. But sure. When they get to about soda can thick, that's really kind of an adult build for them. I try to get them into 6-foot visions at that point with 60 to 75 watt basking light. Otherwise, they're in 4-foot visions with a 40 to 60 watt basking light. And they're, you know, the vision stacks. The males tend to go on the bottom so that as the heat rises in the cages, it's the females that are getting the more heat. Coming around breeding time, I'm in Chicago, so it's easy. My house gets cold whether I want it to or not. And if it's not cold enough yet, I'll crack a window and let them get a little colder in there.
I think that's gotcha. Another thing that people often when you're doing that, are you still leaving your hot spot the same?
Just I don't follow the rule of I'm from Florida. So when it comes to rule something, I'm completely stupid with it. I had some Loveline Pipo Everglades rat snakes that I just adored, and you know, people knew my name on Kingsnake because of those only, because Kathy Lebotelli ready to come look for me. And I was all excited. I moved up north and I'm like, oh, I can finally brewmate him, get really good clutches, and I killed him. I cannot brewmate. I don't trust myself to brewmate. I love diamond pythons and I will never get them because they kind of need that brumation. But I leave the heat on. The room temperature cools off. They'll go to the cold end. I slow down feedings, but I don't take the heat away. I will drop down to 40 watts instead of 60 or 75.
Okay.
Room temps drop to the 60s. So I do offer them a cooler area, but they still have the ability to get hot, and they use it. So.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I never paid attention to when I was first getting into breeding and such is that if you allow you leave the hot spot, so to speak, and then you just bring the ambient temp down and to get that cooler temperature so that they can still have access to the hot if they would like it, and you know they can cool down too if they want to as well, so.
Cool.
Yeah, I do it just because I'm scared. it took me a couple tax returns to get these things. I don't want to lose them from, you know, upper respiratory. I never had respiratory issues with them because of that, I think.
Lucky you.
But, yeah, I always keep the heat on for everything.
Huh, okay.
In Florida, the only way I was ever able to cycle is I changed the lights. I got real geeked out for a couple years trying to get my animals to give me eggs earlier so I could, you know, hopefully have Daytona table with enough babies that were feeding already by the time Daytona rolled around, and it really worked out for me in the heyday of Daytona. But I was able to move my hatch dates 2 months just by changing the light cycle.
Huh.
People kind of forget it's just that easy. You can change the light cycle and change when you feed them, and snakes aren't going to argue with you what time of year it is. So.
Wow, that's interesting. So basically, you're changing your light cycle, and you got, wow, that's pretty cool.
Well, I looked at the, when I got eggs, when I got breedings and everything for 1 year, what the light cycle was, you know, what time of year it was, and I took the calendar and just changed that by a month and changed all my lights to mimic that. So I was a month earlier, and the following year I got a month earlier, and I still wanted an extra month, so I did it again the following year. And like clockwork, all the eggs came a month earlier. So I moved my hatch dates by 2 months just by going in. I had a digital light timer that I was able to change. I could set a full week's worth of times. So I was in there every week on Sunday changing the times, and then after 2 years of that, I was just like, screw this. This is ridiculous. you know what it was? I went into a show, and I'm all proud. I'm excited. I'm like, I got babies that are like 2 months out of the egg, and they've been fed, and look at them. They got 10 pinks in them. This is awesome. And some kid walks up and he goes, oh, well, that guys are $5 cheaper.
Oh,
forget it. You know what? And I just, it kind of burned me out. And it's, that's kind of the reason I'm into Susties and Spilotes and Blackheads, is that if you want one of these animals, or Amazon tree boas, if you want one of these animals, you have options. You can buy wild-caught if they're available, or find somebody to breed them. And when you get a limited number of people breeding something, you completely eliminate that whole $5 less crap, and you don't have that hassle. I still keep some cheap stuff. I throw it on the table because it pays for the table.
Agreed.
You have corn snakes or whatever.
Yeah,
on the
king
table
snakes
to,
or whatever. The occasional ball python if no one's looking. Yeah, you know.
Never a ball python.
No, I'm not sorry. All right? It was a moment of weakness. God damn it! I'm never. All right, shut up.
But yeah, I keep some common stuff because you need that, and it's also it gives you a chance to talk to people and you know. Term from the dark side of the common crap in the hobby. Not that there's any crap, but if there, you know, when I first got into the hobby on a grand scale, I was going down to all the different wholesalers in Florida and seeing all this incredible stuff coming in the country, and I was like, wow. And you know, someday I really want to work with red-tailed green rat snakes. Well, it took me 15 plus years to be able to find some that were captive born and get them, but I am finally working with them. And same with Spilotes. I would see them come in, and I'd love to work with them, but they just didn't handle the stress of the import process well, and they all ended up dying. So it took me years to finally find somebody that could captive breed them. And, you know, people eventually learn. But you can, if you can get these kids, and they're looking at a corn snake, and, oh, what's that? Oh, it's a Spilotes. What's a Spilotes? Oh, it's a tiger rat snake. Oh, what's that? Oh, they get, like, 10 to 14 feet long, and they stare at you when you walk in the room, and they eat like they're starving to death no matter what you're doing.
oh, really? Yeah,
wow.
Cool. Hey, check them out. Oh, they puff up. And kids are like, oh, wow, that's amazing. I've never even heard of that before. It's like, cool.
Yeah.
Now you've been educated. Now you can, you have an option instead of a ball python or a corn snake.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, that's a great way to approach that, because I think that, you know, that's kind of what led me to Morelia. It's the same type of thing. You know, it's like everybody was into, you know, ball pythons or boa constrictors or corn snakes or whatever. And it was like, I wanted something different, you know. Not many people keep Halmahera scrub pythons, you know. And,
right.
And probably
yeah,
nobody,
that.
Nobody will really care.
When you do a show and you throw one on your table and you got a guy walking around the show that, you know, the Mark Bells or whoever, and they spot that from across the room, and they beeline over to your table. It's like, that's, you know, that's a real snake dude.
Yeah,
he's,
I mean,
he's in it for the business. He really knows his stuff, and that's a real snake guy, and he wants to come check out what you got because it's not something he sees every day, because he's bored to death with everything too. And when you hear those guys
people
walking around,
they go right by the, yeah, I mean, they, you know, those people at the shows, you go right by, like, Eric and I walk around the show, and I'm like looking at the table, I'm like, nope, 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 hello, what's this over here? So yeah, it's, you can always tell the snake people from the common folk. So
yeah, absolutely. People were bitching about Finley last year and it was too big, which one is funny to me, but I walked through the show, and what took time was walking through the people, but the tables were easy enough to go through because it was, it actually, there was great variety at the show last year. People were complaining it was a giant ball python fest. It's like, well, it's because you're an idiot. You didn't look around. There,
right.
You know, you had guys there with Asian rats. You had guys there with Kribos. There was all sorts of stuff there, but you spend too much time looking at the same couple ball python morphs, and you don't pay attention to the other guys, and, yeah, it's a ball python show.
Yep.
Get out there and look around. There's a ton of people there with stuff.
Yeah. I think that's why it's kind of important that guys with the with species that are not necessarily mainstream that do shows like that, so that they can do exactly what you're doing, educate people about a species. Because like I said at the beginning of the show, I don't think you can really fully appreciate something until you're looking at it right in front of you. I mean, you can look at pictures all day on Facebook or on a forum or wherever, but it doesn't have that same effect of when you have it either in your hands or you're looking at it in somebody else's hand. You know?
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And nothing makes you want to buy it more than when it's in someone else's hand.
Ain't that the truth? I want that. Yeah, exactly. Oh, okay.
I saw it first behind you.
Yeah. Through yeah. you.
Well, we're going to talk about, I think one of the craziest things with the blackheads is, you know, the reptile feeders in the wild, but, and you can hit on those questions about feeding and such, but I'm curious to your approach at that.
Well, I'm of the minority mindset that nothing should be fed mice and rats all the time. I think one is just a horribly cruel thing because, crap, I get sick of ribeye steaks after a month straight of them. I can't see the snakes not having that same problem. And two, nutritionally, people don't, unless you're breeding your own rodents, if you're buying from any supply house, particularly these people that deal with lab surplus stuff, those rodents are not bred for the best betterment of your animal.
No.
They don't think they are, and they're like, because they're told they are. It's like, okay, great. There's a few people out there. I get mice from Mark Bailey. If you can get on his list to get rodents from him, holy crap, are they beautiful. I mean, I got a bag of no poop, bright white mice. I'm like, well, what is this? I haven't seen a mouse like this in years. But he breeds just for snakes. Okay, awesome. But you don't, unless you're getting from guys who are doing it just for the snake business, you're getting surplus stuff, and those things are bred for the very explicit purpose, and the rodent chow is made for the explicit purpose of making more rodents.
Mm.
So it's made to make the rodents fat so they can produce more, because it takes body fat to make babies. Very simple project there. If you want more babies, you need a fatter rodent. Okay, great. So I just can't see feeding all rodents to everything. And right now, Rodent Pro just blew up with the chicks of different sizes. and they've had quail for years, and a few other people are carrying quails and rodents, quails and chicks as well. And there's a few quail places around the country that they breed them for food or for sport hunting, and in the off season, they're willing to sell you stuff at a fairly decent price. My only problem with one guy out of Georgia's is they're just too damn big. He's like 2-pound quail. It's like, what is this?
Jesus Christ.
But yeah, no, I feed everything, absolutely everything, whether it's a corn snake or ATB, anything. I feed mice, rats, chickens, chicks, and quail to everything. I just think it does a better service to them as animals. I don't see a particularly stinkier, runnier stool, but then again, it keeps pelotes, which poop in 2 days, so they have a pretty working stool no matter what. But, the boas, I have common boas, they'll take the bigger chicks and quail with joy and gusto. I've got a woman that won't take anything else but chicks. I picked her up at Assembly Park a couple of years ago and brought her home, and she was just obese. I'm like, oh, I'm going to put her on a diet. So I went to feed her a rat like once a month, and she'd take a rat now and then, and I wasn't really paying that much attention. Then I kind of started looking at how much she's eating, and it's like, wow, she's eaten like 2 rats in 8 months. This is like, I wanted to get her thinner, but holy crap, this is terrible. And then I started offering chicks and quail and everything else, and the birds, no problem. She'll take all the chicks and quail I go on a feeder, but she won't touch a rat for some reason. And then maybe that's why the guy was getting rid of her to begin with, that she had somehow gotten hooked on a food item or something. But aside from her being weird, I don't have anything that gets hooked on certain prey. If I offer them prey, they eat. But I try to just give them some variety.
Huh. Now, sorry, Owen, I'm jumping in here, but do you...
Go right ahead.
I'm sure you've heard Derek Roddy's approach where he feeds smaller meals more often. Do you follow that, or are you feeding once a month type of thing?
I feed them everything is on like a 7 to 14 day, when do I possibly have time to get in here and feed everything kind of schedule. Now that babies are popping out, I do a lot more baby feeding days on purpose and just schedule them. I think we were talking on Facebook about this. My website's 2 years out of date. I don't do this for a living. I do this for fun. I do this for a hobby. And I work as a locksmith for a living. So if I get calls, especially at night, that's money. I got to go get those calls. So I don't necessarily have the ability to plan feeding days without losing money.
Right.
So when babies come out, I just absolutely do. Wednesday feeding day, not taking any calls. The way it's got to be. Okay. And that's just how it happens. But when it's not babies, the adults can go, 7 to 14 days, no problem. They don't even care. If I start seeing them look particularly hungry, or a lot of them looking hungry, then I'll make a point to try to feed them. But I don't schedule things like some people do. But I don't feed the oversized adults, the fatty adult rats, because of Derek and other people saying you got to keep their meals lean. So they're getting small and medium rats. Some of the bigger girls, my bigger pair, I'm a try rabbits on and see if they like them or not. They're getting, probably close to 8 feet long now. So a small or medium rat, you can't even tell they ate it. I need to get them something bigger in there.
But they also, they'll take chicks and the bigger chicken that are available, they'll take those as well. I do try to feed everything a little bit of variety.
Okay.
Gotcha. Hmm. I've also heard of, like, fish and snake. Do you offer your blackheads that?
Snakes, no, just because if I have a snake that's available. Well, I should say, not to my adults. I've offered snakes to the babies when I've had dead an egg or just failure to thrive. Snakes, and
right.
None of my baby blackheads have ever taken a snake. try as I might, whether I've, you know, I had a terrible carpet hatch this year. Out of 9 eggs, I think I got 5 good babies. But the 4 dead and egg, I offered to my yearling blackheads that are just pounding food like crazy, and they had no interest. So
well, that might help because we won't eat potential mates later on in life. So
the,
yeah,
the
it's good enough
thing,
to train them that that's okay.
Derek's spoiled because he's down in Florida, and you can just go out and cast net a couple mullet and freeze them and try them later on. But up here in Chicago, I don't have the option of fish in the backyard. I get out of Lake Michigan, which is kind of creepy. But otherwise, they're all cleaned.
All right.
And I think if you take the gut content out, you're losing a lot of nutrition value.
Right.
Fish parasites and reptile parasites are close enough that it kind of creeps me out too.
Right, right. That would upset me. Yeah.
And I caught some hypo Florida water snakes down in Florida, and I was just thrilled to death with those things, and I was just so excited I was going to breed hypo water snakes, and then I fed them a couple times, and they crapped out basically 4-day-old fish, and. I mean, that's exactly what it smelled like. It smelled like somebody had a pile of fish that they managed to keep moist in the sun for 4 days, and that's how it came out. And that's another reason I don't want to try it. I think, man, the pythons are great because they'll dehydrate the food, and they're, you know, they have the nice dry feces normally, so maybe it wouldn't be that bad. But that's another iffy thing there for me. I don't think I want to.
Wow. Yeah,
whatever you find up here.
I wouldn't either. So, if you could rate the difficulty of breeding the species blackhead from 1 to 10, where would you put it?
I'd like to be all like, yeah, I'm a badass, and they're a 10. I don't see it, man. They breed. That's what they do. Like I said earlier, every snake wants to breed. The difficulty isn't getting eggs. The difficulty is getting the eggs to all the way through to hatch.
Okay.
And I think that's just a matter of getting your incubator tuned in right. They need to be.
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, how would you set up your eggs?
Well, I've got pictures on my Facebook of it, but it's the same as I think all the ball python guys are doing now with the light diffuser grate, lifting the eggs above the substrate. But I use a perlite. I put some deli cups in there to get it even higher off the substrate itself. So I have the substrate below, deli cups holding the grate up, eggs on the grate, and you just got to keep any moisture that might accumulate inside the egg box off the eggs. One drop on the egg and that just kiss the egg goodbye.
Jesus, so, really?
I mean, once you get, and that's heartbreaking, man, because you go all year, you only get one litter. When as the females get bigger, you know, you can, a 7-foot blackhead, you can go year to year and still get good eggs. But once you get 8-9 feet long, they've retick size eggs. I really want to, I always say this, but I actually do want to see a 18-foot retick female's egg size and just compare it to a blackhead and see. So that's really what it seems like to me. They're just these ginormous eggs. But once they get much over 8 feet, you really got to give them a year off. I mean, it's just such a huge amount of their body mass that comes out of them when they lay those eggs. You can't, keep in mind, you don't want to be feeding them high-fat diets. You
right.
can't really get them back up to a healthy breeding weight in time for the following season, usually.
Right.
So when you get an egg go bad, it's not only that you lost an egg, but you lost 2 years sometimes.
Damn.
That's just painful. But if you keep them dry, I've got 11 eggs sitting next to me on day 56, I think it is, that I got 11 eggs from the female, and 56 days later, I still have 11 eggs.
That's good.
Keep them dry, but keep them. It's a terrible mixture of bone dry eggs with 100% humidity in the incubation chamber. And if you can balance that, it's easy. My first year, out of 14 good eggs, I had 11 to hatch. Second year, it was, I think, I went 7 for 7. Third year, I did lose a couple. But I will say the ones that I lost, it seemed like they got wet. When you cut the eggs open, they go bad in the first week or so. And I kind of think the eggs just, the babies didn't make it coming out of the mother for some reason. Too tight getting squeezed out, whatever it is, and they just died coming out. And it's not even the wetness that's killing them, it's just that they were already dead coming out of the egg, and then they kind of take on that moisture anyway, because they, you know, you can look at the development when you cut them open. At least I cut open every egg, and they all, no matter when they go bad, they seem to have the same amount of development, which is almost none.
Difficulty-wise,
I think realistically, if you, the hardest thing to me is just getting them all feeding. And that's a whole trick in and of itself, but the breeding is they're happy to breed. The eggs are more a 9. Like, the breeding's like a 6, the eggs are a 9, and getting the hatchings to feed are like an 8 or a 9.
Okay. But, so they're up there, so they're like an intermediate kind of a snake, maybe.
Yeah, well, I don't think, they're not as hard as everybody thinks they are.
Okay.
I thought they'd be a lot harder, but they're definitely not easy. They're definitely not a ball python, but they're not Bolins. I mean,
right.
People are getting eggs every year from them.
Right. So I guess once you get your routine down, you get your motions, you figure out everything, it comes pretty easy. But it might be a little difficult to, you know, lay down your plan and get it going, I guess.
I'm so anxious about it every year. I have my incubator on and running probably a month before I ever have eggs. And I get the boxes in there, and I try to cook them for a while just to see if they're going to be kicking up a lot of moisture. And I make adjustments. And by the time I get the eggs, I'm confident they're sitting there looking pretty. Then I check the eggs every 2 or 3 days to make sure there's no moisture buildup.
Okay. So, well, you, Eric, were you listening? Incubators are important, is the gist I got from there. Are you understanding that?
Have you ever had any or heard of anybody doing maternal incubation with a blackhead?
I have not here. I'm sure somebody in Australia has done it.
That's cheating, though. They're from there. Yeah. I open the door and they bred. It's crazy.
Yeah, I think everybody here gets so excited they throw up an incubator and start dancing for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to take somebody like Derek or Tom that have a ton of animals, or, you know, who would probably may have tried it would have been Mark Bell.
No.
We were sitting at Tinley one year, a couple of years ago, and somebody was talking to me about blackheads, and Mark was at the table next to me, and, you know, this is like Saturday night. We're all out drinking after the auction, and Mark kind of leans over and says, you got blackheads, kid? I'm like, yeah, I got a pair at home. And he's like, a pair? Huh. And he kind of gave me a smirk like, yeah, that's cute.
Right.
I'm like, what, do you guys ever breed blackheads? Yeah, I used to have like 60 or so. I was like, oh,
oh, wow.
I never heard of him produce them, so I don't know how successful he was with them.
Wow, 60 blackheads, good lord.
What do you do? That's the cave space. My God.
Bell's got more of everything than anybody, I think. Comes down to it.
Yeah. There was a video of their facility, and it's unbelievable how much, it's just crazy what they have going on.
If some of the guys get online, they're like, oh, this guy's got the biggest breeding facility in the country, and or this guy's got this guy. And it's like, have you seen Mark Bell's place? If you don't need a car to drive through it, it's not the biggest one.
Let's go to building A. What? So, if it's not a compound, you're failing.
Well, you mentioned the difficulty of getting them to feed. And we had Derek on the show before, and he talked about that. He doesn't even mess around with it. He just force feeds them straight from the go. What's your approach? Do you have any tips? Do you have any tips or tricks or anything that you've learned or any kind of knowledge you can give to us about
it? Yeah. Well, going back to I try every food type. I give them once they shed, and well, part of the issue is they don't even want to eat for the first month. They come out of the egg. I'm sure you've seen my pictures of Derek's of the babies, and they're just like these bloated masses that can barely crawl, and they kind of lay on their side. And they just suck up so much yolk and moisture. They've got food for months. So it's like you don't have to get them going immediately, and they're not going to eat for a month at least until they give you like two or three good poops. They're still full. But once they process all that, I give them, like I said, I start right away on their first shed, but I give them usually the first month or so before I even expect them to eat. But I offer them a pinky mouse, a rat pinky, a mouse fuzzy, and a quail chick.
Wow.
Just let it go. And I've heard people say that they want giant food items. And if you're like carpets, if you're offering pinkies, they're not going to eat it. And I've come back and all they've taken is a pinky. I'm like, okay, well, that doesn't work. But it's funny because they'll randomly take one thing and it's never consistent. It's like not even like one animal will take the mouse pinky every time. But they'll take one thing. And then one day they'll show up and everything's gone. And they're back to that gigantic bloated look again. It's like, holy crap, how did you even fit all that inside of you? But
are you feeling okay? I mean, that's horrible.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, it's like Thanksgiving for them. But then I come back the next week and I try it again and they do it again. They'll take down everything. But even now I get yearlings that I'm still doing the same thing for them. I'm offering everything and letting them eat all of it because, like I said, I think it gives them a good nutritional basis to be grabbing day-old quail chicks that, you know, they're fresh out of the egg. Who knows what's going on nutritional-wise for them? Fuzzy mice, that's, you know, a couple weeks old, and then rat pinks, fresh out of the mom. So they're grabbing all this different stuff, different age groups, and it's got to be different nutritional values. I'm not in this for the money, so I'm happy to sit on them for a year and get them feeding strongly, so when I give them to somebody, I don't have to ever hear, oh, it's not feeding. It's like, screw you, dude. I got 10 months of feeding records. How's it not feeding?
Right.
What did you do?
Yeah. Well, if it's not feeding, you're doing something wrong.
Right.
But if they don't feed for 3 or 4 months, then I start force feeding. I don't jump on it right away. And Derek told me, just don't even worry about stuff. Pinkies down their throat every day, and they'll eventually eat. And, yeah.
Oh, God.
But if they're not feeding, I'll try to fry their mouth open, which is like the hardest thing in the world because they're like little bulldogs. Once they get a little bit of age on them, even if they're not feeding, they still grow from all that yolk. And once I get their mouth open, I'll just stuff either a fuzzy mouse or a small adult mouse or a quail chick head in their mouth and just get the head in there and get it far enough down where I can close their mouth and kind of pull back on it to kind of set their teeth in it. And then just drop them in the drawer and back away and don't even let them see me in the room. And half the time they'll eat, and the other half the time they won't. So I'll try that, you know, once or twice on a feeding day if they don't eat. If they haven't eaten in a long time, I'll force feed something completely. If they have eaten recently, then I'll just let them be.
Okay.
Right.
Huh. Yeah, I kind of... I take the approach that, you know, if it eats, it eats, and I'm not going to try to rush it, you know. So,
right.
I approach that with everything, you know.
You'd be waiting a long time with some blackheads. And the first year I had 11, of those 11, 9 were actually healthy. I had 2 that were just kind of goofy from the get-go, and the female that produced them had not been bred for like 5 or 6 years. I think she just had some funky old eggs in her or something. But anyways, the 9 I got going, I ended up losing 1 or 2 of those just as they just would never feed for me. I mean, I've gotten better with it, but still I've got 2 from last year that are still on and off. generally once they like fully eat on their own without you having to start them or assist them at all, they never turn back and they'll eat everything from that point forward. But I
right.
try myself to assist need.
Okay.
So they're a pain in the butt.
Oh, wonderful.
Now, how do Woma pythons, how are they in comparison to blackheads? Are they easier? Are they the same? Or what's
egg-wise, just as bad, if not worse. I've had actually worse luck catching Womas. I'm like retarded
really?
When it comes to snakes. I have a pair of common boas that literally every person that owns a trailer and a pair of boas in Florida produces boas. I lived down there for years, could never get them to produce for me. I got a pair of boas that are like 12 years old and have never produced for me.
Wow.
What my problem is. But blackheads, no problem. Womas, some iffy on. But as far as Womas, I got, what is it, nine baby Womas and seven of them took their first meal in the first try. So people.
Oh,
like,
wow.
People in the ball python world expect prices to just tank every year. Like, oh, well, it was $1,500 last year. It should be $500 this year. Like, no, it's $1,500 this year. There's, you know, there's, what, eight guys breeding blackheads in the country right now? Eight, nine guys, maybe?
Right.
At least that you see posted on Kingsnake or anything.
Right.
Right.
Huh. That's
sorry. Hold on one second.
No.
Ignore a call here. but anyways, the Womas, on the other hand, yeah, their prices dropped real quick because everybody got into them. But then, ironically, everybody got out of them because the price was dropping.
Right.
So like 3 years ago at Tinley, there was like probably 200 Woma babies at the show, and last year I think there was two.
Wow.
So,
wow.
I was just like, holy crap. And I, of course, all my Womas tank last year. I didn't get a single good egg. This year, at least I have nine. But the prices dropped on them because they do feed easier. The eggs are difficult, but not as difficult. Breeding them is just as easy as blackheads. They all want to breed. But the feeding's easier, and I think that allows the big, large-scale producer of snakes an easier time because they can just throw a food item in there and walk away and
right.
You know, 70% of the time they're going to eat.
Right.
So it's not like the blackhead, you can't do that. It's just they're a different beast.
Right.
So Womas are awesome. I love Womas and I wish we had some localities of Womas here in this country. They have in over in Australia, but unfortunately, don't, and unfortunately, they don't get the respect price wise that I think they should get in this country. You know, our prices just
right.
tank. Whereas Australia, I think they're still better than the blackheads over there.
I had a trio of Womas, and they hated my guts, so I sent them away. they were just oh. So
there's some guys that get so pissed off because they've had Womas for years and just never get them produced. And I right now I've got, 1.5, and I've got, basically I have nine babies. I mean, 1.5, so five breedable adult females, and I got one good litter out of them. They can be tough.
Wow.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Womas are much harder to breed than blackheads, and I just don't know enough.
Right. When you say you have 1.5, do you breed that male to multiple females a year, or is it just one pairing that you do?
I try to breed them. I initially had 1.1, and I picked up an extra pair of females because I figured I'd give them, you know, one a year off every year. And then through the Herp Society, somebody was just getting rid of their animals, and one of the animals that needed to be adopted was a Woma female. I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll adopt that, sure. $10 adoption fee? All right, here you go.
But
twist my arm.
It's good to be the president of society sometimes.
Yeah.
But they, I tried to breed them because they were all good this year. I gave my one female that I produced 2 years ago last year off, and then I picked all the other ones up over the last 18 months. And I tried to breed them all this year, and I got terrible luck. So my wife, she's actually in the room, so I can say it. My wife actually said, we need to get another male. Oh, okay, honey, I'll go buy another snake then. She's been
well, if
down
you
a
say
lot,
so, like, dear. God.
Oh, that's cool.
She says, baby, you need to have enough males to breed your females, or it doesn't make any sense to have all the females, so go get another male. All right, baby.
I like that thinking.
I would have been deer in the headlights, like, this is a trap. What do you want? So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would take me a minute. You're serious, right? Really? What? Yeah. So, God.
Awesome.
Yeah, she had a couple of weak moments the last couple months here. She gave me the okay to buy a pair of Chinese beauties last weekend.
Oh, dear Lord.
So I was kind of
stunned. Wow. They've
been fun so far.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I wanted you to hit on your you gave a Woma CPR. I thought that was a pretty interesting story.
What?
And I thought that you should share it with everybody.
Please, God, do.
So out of my 9 babies that I tried to feed, 2 of them didn't eat. So I deli cupped them with the fuzzy. And they still didn't eat, those 2. So I took those 2 after they, you know, a day later had just demolished the fuzzy, and it was just juiced and goo everywhere. And I threw them in some cups to soak and just get all the grime off them. And I tried washing them off. And then I just, after they were soaking for a little bit, I squirted a little soap in there. And the one was just fine. He was just chilling, no problems. And the other one was just churning up just swimming in circles, churning up the water. And I kept walking in and out of the room where they were soaking and checking on them, and walked out, did something for a little bit and came back. And I saw the female just created this huge mass of bubbles. I thought, oh, isn't that cute? She's making a bubble bath. I looked closer and she was upside down.
Oh, no.
Oh, crap. So it'd been like 5 minutes. I'm just checking right now. She is still alive. But, yeah, I pulled her out and I threw her out on my top of my freezer just to get a good look at her. And I was trying to see if I could see a heartbeat or anything. And I tried to just hang her upside down and get some water out of her. And I didn't see anything coming out. And like I said, I tried bringing back my adult female that had been smothered to death. And I had talked to a vet buddy of mine, like, well, you know, where is the heart if I try to, you know, give CPR again? He's like, oh, it's right here, and it probably would work. So I thought, no, let me try. So I started, you know, just kind of gave a couple small massages of where the heart area should be, and I had a feeding tube just kind of laying there next to me, and I grabbed that and just blew some air into her, her air hole in the bottom of her mouth, and hung her upside down again. And I did that a second time, and at that point, with it laying upside down, I could hear just like a very faint heartbeat come back.
Oh,
like, great. So I started watching for respiration and nothing. So I kept trying the little straw, basically blowing air down her windpipe, and she eventually kind of twitched and her tail started moving. I was like, oh, God, thank you. But, yeah, it's not my – everybody's like, oh, great job. I'm like, oh, that was really stupid to throw in there with soap to, you know, why not just wash her off? But I'm glad I didn't kill her.
Jesus.
I don't really want a pat on the back for being an idiot.
Yeah, but at least you were able to save her. I mean, that's I've never heard of anybody giving CPR to a snake. So, I mean, if there's ever an emergency.
Well, you know, one of our members did that at a show. She also had a problem where I think there's just a transport thing where the snake had somehow got smothered or something in a transport to from a show, or I don't recall what the issue was. Actually, I just recall hearing the story of her. It was an adult snake, and she was apparently giving it mouth to mouth,
directly in a parking lot and got a bunch of weird.
Oh my god!
Like, so, she's basically the individual is like a real life version of Kitty from that '70s show. It's just like adorable, cute Midwestern mother.
Right.
She's out there blowing in a snake's mouth in the middle of a parking lot.
That's hilarious.
But yeah, that worked for them as well. So I think that's probably what was in the back of my head when I thought about it to begin with, is that I know someone else has done it, so why not? Give it a shot.
Why not? If it works, well, no harm in trying.
Yeah. No, I hate to see anything die ever under my care, especially if it's completely my fault like that. So do what I can.
Jeez, that's awesome.
Cool stuff. All right, Alan.
That's so cool. All right. Thank you, sir. let's talk Amazon tree boas. Them along with the emerald tree boas are probably the two snakes that scare me the most of, like, if I have it, oh, good, oh, I killed it. So how do you set up your Amazon tree boas?
Again, my mishmash cage of whatever's closest to what they, I think, will work with for them. I've got, right now, in the room I'm looking in, I've got three of the old-school Neodesha two-foot cubes that a lot of the chondro people like to use, the old chondro people that are, that is. There's, I don't know if you ever heard of the Itzo cages. I think, actually, that was brought up in some chondro forums as well. The Itzo storage boxes, I-T-S-O, they're just a box, and put some glass on the front somehow. I use tracks and some pipes in there, and they seem to love them. Otherwise, I have some in drawers, babies I set up in little plastic food storage bins and just keep their humidity way up and their heat high and get them to feed that way. But for the most part, it's just a matter of getting their humidity up. They do need 60 plus on the humidity. I mean, some people want to go as high as 80 plus. I just find it really difficult to keep it that high. So I aim for 60, and if it gets below that, then I definitely make some changes to fix things. But and then heat them. They do fine with high heat, but I don't go much over 90 if I can help it.
Okay.
And they've done well for me.
With controlling the humidity, are you finding, are you misting down? Is that how you're improving that? Or what's your approach with that?
Yeah, mist or fogger, it depends on which cage it is, too. I do throw some foggers on once in a while, but I find foggers tend to make it too wet. I end up having problems with them that way. But yeah, I usually just mist. I use cypress mulch for the bedding, and that helps keep some of the moisture in. And midwinter, going, you know, store to store trying to find anybody that has any cypress mulch in Chicago is always a fun challenge.
Yep.
Usually it's frozen solid, and by the time you get it home, it's actually usually pretty wet when you thaw it. But you just have to thaw it fully, because I've had it where there's still ice crystals in it like 3 days after it's been in my house. Which I don't know how that works, but I just throw in the cypress mulch, some fresh cypress, and it brings the humidity right back up. Or misting them all the time. It's a battle, but soaking them when they have bad sheds is another option. But people just need to keep in mind that a bad shed is not the only issue with low humidity. They also need the high humidity for their lung function and everything. So if you have low humidity consistently, they're going to have other issues. I took in a rescue ATB that I brought to my vet, and he said that the snake basically had arthritis from too low humidity. You could just feel like
no way
chunks in its body, like it was crunchy. It was so... When it originally got rescued by a different member of the Herp Society, he said he pulled off 6 or 7 sheds that were just caked over it. The guy who he got it from said it was 18 years old, So I don't know how you have an animal for 18 years and allow it to get six or seven sheds on it, because that's some, if you kept it alive that long, you kind of had to have some clue, hopefully. But apparently this guy just lost interest or whatever, and we got it. Another member rescued it and got it in shape, and then he got tired of it, and I got it from him. And I brought it to my vet just to check it out, and he's like, yeah, that's like actual salt crystals inside the muscles from it just being too dry. I don't know that it was even possible.
No, you
can do about it.
That's crazy.
So,
wow.
Yeah, the community is not just the shed thing.
Really? Does the one with the arthritis have trouble moving, or did it have trouble moving?
I had it for, he had it for like 3 years, and I had it for another, I think, 3 or 4 years. So it got over 20 years old before it finally died in my care. Just got to the point where me and a buddy of mine, both for the Tinley Expo and for an educational expo we did, and for the educational expo is where I had him out. We set up this like PVC tubing setup that was high off the ground, so people couldn't get that close to him. And then we just sat there with snake hooks, pushing people back from this PVC assemblage. And we put like 15 Amazon tree boas up there, just so people could see all the different colors and looks and pattern they could possibly have. And it was an awesome exhibit. But that poor guy, I put him up there, and it was like almost all females except for three males, and he was one of the three males. And if one of the other males would come by, he would get like startled and just fall off. We had to take him off that exhibit. But yeah, and that was like 5 years ago, 4 years ago. So he had some issues at that point already. And then as his age progressed, I was actually thinking about just bringing him in and have him put down, because he just looked so miserable. He would have a bad shed like every other shed, no matter what the humidity was. He just didn't have the energy to like get the shed off or anything. He got pretty bad at the end.
Okay, so humidity is important. Okay. So
yeah,
what do these guys like to work with? Because, I mean, I've dealt with emeralds and green trees and other types of arboreal. Never really had the Amazon tree boas, but they seem fragile to me. So
they're without a doubt the hardiest of the three.
Jesus.
they're the dumb guys emerald. I mean, emeralds, you got to have that tuned in and perfect. And Amazons, you can screw up 90% of what you're doing, and they're just, okay, well, you're an idiot, but I'll do what I can to survive. You know, emerald just drop off the tree on you, just die. So they can definitely take some keeper terror, which allows you to fine tune your keeping. Thankfully, so there's a bit longer term option there. But people always, it annoys me, because within the hobby, you know, we have as hobbyists together, we fight the idiots in the general public. But then within the hobby, people always want to say that this snake's a biter. Like, is it, or do you, what's your experience? Well, condors are all biters. Well, when they were all imports, or now when they're all captive? Amazons are biters. Well, yeah, when they're, you know what they go through? I've gotten in Amazons or bought them at shows that were just like stunning animals. I have one here in my collection now that when I got it, it was fresh. The guy said he got it in like 2 weeks previous. It was covered in mites, which I thought, okay, I can handle that. And I could see some marks on its neck, and I'm like, I don't know what that is. And then it had a stub tail that was an old wound. But it's this big, giant, beautiful yellow female. So I got her, and he's like, oh, she's mean as can be. And I'm like, all right, that's cool. And I brought her home, and she actually was me, and I showed her to a buddy of mine, and he's like, oh, you know, those marks on her neck, that's a noose mark. What? He's like, yeah, the natives are scared of, when they catch them, they noose them out of the trees. They don't want to get hit either. And if you think about that, everybody, and even in the U.S. here, I remember going into the wholesale shops, guys are going, put on gardening gloves or leather gloves, and going and pin the snakes down, grab them by their head, hold them hard, probably fracture or break bones in their neck, jam in the bags, of course they're going to be mean. But
I'd be pissed too.
I've got both. Yeah, I got captive and wild caught snakes, Amazons that I trust completely.
Okay.
And when I say completely, like when they have a bad shed, I'll soak them and then I'll sit down on the edge of my tub and start trying to work the skin off them. And I'm generally in shorts, or if it's hot, I'm in boxers, and I'll be sitting there, and I like laugh to myself because like the snakes will like be on. I'll get most of the shed off of them, and they'll be on the ground and come back and wrap up my leg, and then being like underneath my thigh, and I'm thinking, I don't know of any other snake I trust as much to allow it there, and I never have problems with them. I got 23 Amazons, of which my wild-caught female hates the smell of humans. She will bite herself if you touch her. If she smells you on her, she'll bite herself.
Oh, it sucks.
And she's the one that had the noose mark, so completely excuse her.
Yeah.
I've got a captive-born tiger. I think she just had somebody that was scared of snakes that owned her first before me, and she's pretty snappy. I think she just had some rough handling. I got one other wild caught that also is snappy. Other than that, the rest of my animals are easy enough to deal with. They occasionally try to bite, but they're not bad. You just got to handle them appropriately. You got to, don't put them in your face, don't breathe on them, and let them kind of feel like you're a tree and you're good to go. But it makes me crazy when our own hobby is like, oh, they're terrible, they'll bite your face off.
I hate that. Well, and they come right up to your table. Like, carpet pythons are mean. And I'm like, dude, you don't know that? Shut up.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right.
But
Jesus. So,
I got babies that are completely sweet coming out of the mother. And I would love to tell you that my mean female produced all mean babies and it's heritable. She produced some absolutely sweet babies. Different female, but my other female that's a biter occasionally, she produced a baby that girl that got her has all these pictures with her crawling over her face and everything on Facebook, and just a completely sweet snake. And I've got a couple that from really sweet animals that come out swinging. So as of yet, I don't see it being heritable, but if you think about corn snakes in the wild, they bite you when you first pick them up, but you never get a captive corn to bite you.
Right.
There's an ability to kind of calm them with breeding eventually.
That's cool. So what kind of morphs are you working with currently?
The ATVs are so variable and so just cool. In all the different color forms. I'm not that into the morphs. I do have a tiger, a garden phase tiger female. One big thing is everybody who doesn't know ATVs always wants to say they have Cook's boas. There are no Cook's boas in this country. If there are, there's like six. Cook's have been exported out of the island, which is not Cook's Island, but it's another island. Cook's are named after a guy.
Right.
That island hasn't allowed exportation since like 1978 or something. If there's any Cooks left in this country, they're ancient or they're F2s or something. But everybody called, I think, gardens Cooks, I think is what it was, or colored ones Cooks or something. I don't know. But there's no Cooks left in the country, as far as I'm concerned, at least. I have yellows and oranges and gardens. I have the one tiger, and that's it right now. There's cool stuff happening. It's like the blackheads. There's really cool stuff happening, but the people that have those animals are not – it's not a realistic group of people that are going to – we're not going to see them for 5 or 10 years.
Right.
The pricing, you're getting into ball python pricing at that point. The other thing is with the Amazons is it's argumentative whether or not the leopard phase is simple recessive or codominant. People have different answers. People that bred them in the past said they were simple recessive, and now people that are breeding them now are saying they're codominant. I wonder, one particular breeder, I'm wondering if they don't have such a big group that they didn't produce Hets and kind of forget about it, and now they're producing Leopards past the time out of those Hets they produced.
That's almost what I'm thinking.
You know, like, oh, sure, I forgot they were Hets.
It makes sense. It makes sense that you would lose the genetic and then all of a sudden it's popping up again. You can't explain it because you forgot. But, you know, kind of
Tigers are definitely Kodam, and those those are all over the place. The Hypo, there's the Hypo that the one guys have that produced the Leucistic. I don't know if that's Hypo. I don't think it is. I saw it in person, and there was Black Specs, but ATBs are so weird because they have their, you know, they're born with one color phase, and as they mature, there's a melanin that comes in later on in life that's not necessarily associated with the other colors you're observing. So you could almost have albinism or hypomelanism on the base birth colors, and the later melanin that comes in ignores that, possibly. You know, we don't really know how that color works.
Oh, that would that's weird. That's weird.
Speculation completely. I'm not saying that's how it works.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You could have something going on like that. Because you get animals that are, you know, brick red as babies, and then you see them 6 years old, and they're, like, brown. What the hell happened there? And it's, you know, brown and black. What? And you have animals that are born. I know there's a female, I think it was a female that was born yellow, and now she's a deep orangish red as a sub-adult. So they go through some really crazy color changes.
That's cool.
That's what makes them cool, is that you don't know what you're going to get out of them, even when you have the babies. Like, I've sold off babies, and I see them as later on. I'm like, oh, jeez.
I hate that. Sellers
are
more
than
ever.
Everybody does that, but with Amazon, it's, like, so common.
Oh. All right. I'm not getting them. I couldn't be able to live with myself. But how difficult are they to breed?
I'm like a broken record. I keep saying the same thing. They want to breed. And it makes your life easier because they're not giving you eggs to have to deal with, so spit out a bunch of babies.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
that makes it easy.
A slight cooling, taking the food down, and drying them out a little bit, and they seem to breed for you. Get them wet again as the seasons change. I mean, just kind of looking at what's going on in the Amazon during their winter. Winter is cool and dry, not cold, just cool. So, again, Chicago makes my life easy. It just, no matter what happens, it's cold in my house. So
okay.
I every year I try to breed them. They bred for me. Everything's bred. I haven't had the slug issues. I let them get cold. I give them the hot spot, and like we were talking about earlier, the house can drop down to the 50s, and I'm okay with that as long as I can give them a hot spot as well. I'm not worried about their ambient temperature staying over 80 or anything.
Okay.
And other guys will tell you that's wrong, and that's fine if that works for them a different way. It works for me this way, and I'm happy with it.
Cool.
I got, I think, 6 or 7 females I'm waiting on this year. And as with all boids, it's the worst part of it is that you got to wait forever to see what you get out of them.
Right.
That sucks. So how about young? Like, do you set them up in a bin with a perch, and are they hard to get rolling?
Man, my first year, I had a rough time with them. This past couple years, you know, thanks the internet for making idiots smart all the time here. Just watching other people and what they're doing. I just get some of the Tupperwares and poke some holes in them. What is this? I got a 76-ounce, 9.5-cup storage container. It's like, I don't see what my tape measure is. It's like 10 inches long, 5 wide, and probably 3 tall. Poke some holes in there, throw in the green garden netting so they have some place to climb, and paper towel. The substrate, the humidity stays high as can be, and they feed great for me. I tried just regular racks and had a hell of a time getting them feeding. 2 years ago, I had such a hard time. I had to ask one of my buddies to take a full clutch. I had, I think, 6 clutches, and 1 clutch just was not going for me. And I had to have him do it. And I went over to pick up the babies after I got him feeding. I'm looking at what he's got, and he's just had Tupperwares with the green mesh netting or black mesh netting and paper towels and completely sealed. And I think it's the humidity that really is the big key for them. So with that, it, you know, friends in the internet make you smarter all the time if you let them.
That's the truth. That is the truth.
Awesome.
I've got somebody gave me a container store thing that's, I don't know how many quarts it is, but it's like 10 inches tall. So, you know, you need more height. And then as I got, last year I had 6 clutches. So I had a ton of babies, and I just had to drop down their size, isolate them. They don't like brothers and sisters at all. It really keeps them from feeding, and isolated them, put their humidity up higher and got their heat up, and they were happy to eat. So,
cool. Very cool.
I tried to get way too creative with them.
Oh yeah.
Cool.
I had some of them when I was younger. They were carpet python like to me almost, and that's kind of like what led me into carpet pythons, because I kind of dug them. I thought they were cool, but mine were just wild imports, and they wanted to bite your head off. But that's what makes them fun, you know. That's, I don't know. It's like scrubs
nowadays.
You know,
you can get some captives, raise them gentle so they don't associate you with stress, and I think a big part of them calming down for me is I keep everything in glass front enclosures where they can see me. Like,
okay.
You know, I got wooden floors, so as I walk by, the cages are moving, whether I want them to or not. I'm, you know, I'm 6'8 and 280. The cages are moving when I go by. They see me. They see me go by. There's movement, but I don't touch them. I don't harass them. I don't bother them, and there's no stress. There's a little bit of stress because, hey, what's this guy doing? But there's not that, oh my God, you're going to kill me stress. And I think that eventually they just kind of like, all right, cool. Because people make me crazy ever since back in the old king snake days, and they want to try to break a snake. It's not a horse.
Right.
Handling it is not going to make it calmer. You're just going to stress it out. It might eventually stress out so bad that it calms down, but you're going to stress it out. That's it.
Right.
No stress makes a happy snake.
Right. That's true.
So... everybody, newbies, it's always like, oh, you got to hold your retick every day. Why is your first snake a retick?
Hold it every day. It's going to piss it the hell off. God.
I think you're right, though. I think that with more and more captive breeding, eventually they calm down, and, you know, you see that. And I remember reticks, you bring that up, and I said this before on the show, but when I was young, my dad, he had a retic, and that thing was just pure evil. And now they're like puppy dog tame, you know. There's some retics out there that, you know, are just calm as can be. But I don't know.
Again, it goes back to the importation process, man. These poor animals get neck grabbed and head pinned and jammed and beat up and shifted here and sent there and dehydrated. And I mean, that's like war criminal stuff. And by the time we get them here, they're just pissed and dehydrated and angry. And people don't give credit to snakes. Snakes have, whether you want to look at them as intelligent, they definitely have a memory. You have snakes, even if it's just a memory of their own centrales, there's a memory they have. You see a rattlesnake in the wild. I mean, I brought my ex-girlfriend out to Arizona, and she was like, oh, rattlesnakes, we're going to die. Like, no, they're calm, they're plastic. Come on, let's go. And we went out there, and they even lifting them off, I mean, at night, during the day, it's a whole different ballgame. They see you, you see them, they're scared. But at night, road cruising out in Arizona, you can pull up on a Western Diamondback, 9 times out of 10, they're going to be pretty placid. They're just, they're comfortable, they know where all their centrales lead to. Here's safety, here's heat, here's food. I'm cool, you're cool, don't touch me, don't get too close, everybody's happy. You just gently lift them with a snake hook, move them off the road, they're still calm. I think I moved 10 or 12 out of like the 60 or 70 rattlesnakes we saw that week trip we were out there.
Wow.
Every other one after the first dozen, she was like, oh, can I move it? Can I move it? Can I move it? Because she went from terrified to just like, they're so cute. I think it's the same is true with, you know, with our captives, is that they have a great memory, and you start stressing them out, or they get stressed out and beat up coming in, they're going to associate human with stress, with fear, with danger, and they're going to bite.
Right.
Which
makes sense. Yeah, it makes sense.
And if you limit all of that stress, if they're biters, and that, you know, life sucks, but most of the time they're not, because it's really anti-evolutionary to be biting at things bigger than you and screwing with them, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's true. That's a good observation.
Not a lot of things get to smack something bigger than them and live. So.
We got about 10 minutes left on the show, and I know you had said that you're head of a herb society, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you, talk a little bit about that, and maybe can you hit on, like, the importance of maybe, I wish there was one in our area, Owen, and there is,
mm-hmm.
I don't know about it.
Well,
I thought about
one,
that. How difficult
there's one in
is
Philly.
It?
There is one in Philly, the Philadelphia Herpetological Society, but,
right.
You know, I don't feel like trekking into the city. So.
Oh, okay, well, I didn't know
I don't,
that.
Well, you know, depending where you're at, like Chicago's spoiled. I did the VP thing for a couple of years, and I just love that, man, because VP's only job is to back up the president and get speakers, which meant as long as my president did his job, I had nothing to do but get speakers. I handled that in 3 months because we have the Field Museum, which has like one of the biggest specimen collections out there. So we're trying to get mostly scientists, science-minded people in it. I will tell you, if you were going to be doing society and trying to get speakers, people always want to get the big breeders, the Barchecks and the Bells. Horrible talks. Because how
really?
Many times can you say, like, just talk with me? I mean, it's fun. It's cool. We're hanging out. We're chatting. It's kind of a buddy thing, but it's not, what are we really learning? Well, how do you breed snakes? Well, you put them together and they breed. Okay, great. Scientists bring new things. You learn, and that's what most of us get into this for, is that passion to learn new things and learn about the snakes in particular, or turtles,
sure,
or whatever it is you're into. So scientists make amazing speakers, because they'll do stuff that you would never even think of. Why would you experiment with that? And not only
right.
they experiment, they got really cool results. So anyways, we have the benefit of the Field Museum here having the, like, I think one of the biggest specimen collections out there, and they've just been awesome for us, because we ask anybody, will you come up here and speak? And they're like, yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, the only person I've been able to get up here is Dick Bartlett, and he just very honestly has answered me, I'm too old. Like, I'm just not doing that anymore. I'm too old for that crap. I'm like, all
right,
cool. That I can deal with. But everybody else is like, I'd love to. I don't have time, but let's schedule it for later on. I need to get up anyway.
Right.
But anyways, yeah, Herp Societies, for the fact we have these great speakers coming in, you definitely learn something. If your society's pulling in, especially scientific-minded speakers, you learn something every time. We had a guy come in talking, Rick Sajic, I want to say his name is. He has a book out. I want to say it's Life in the Trees, but I'm terrible. My wife's unfortunately talking to her mother on Skype, so I can't go back where my computer is and look him up. I feel terrible about that. But she's Latina. It's very loud in there. He wrote this book on all these observations of snakes in the trees. And one of the things he observed routinely was in Africa, ball pythons, particularly males, in the trees.
Really?
There's an entire world of ball python keepers that will tell you that ball pythons live in a box, and that's where they want to live. He's
yeah.
had them in trees 8-10 feet off the ground. They're out there hunting
really?
Birds in the right season. So, you know, you learn something no matter what, as long as you show up to the talks. And people are like, oh, why don't I come in? I don't really care anything about, you know, whatever the talk's about. I don't care about garter snakes. like, right. So what? What is it? What is she speaking on? Is it garter snakes or is it snake ecology? And if she's talking on ecology, I'm thinking of a particular speaker that I thought was going to be terrible. That was just stunning. She was good looking, which was a huge benefit, but she had an amazing talk she did. And
right.
It was just a stunning talk, and we're like, wow. And if it was my choice, if I wasn't on the board and I had other things to do, I maybe would have skipped that one. And I'm so glad I needed to be there. So, anyways, we do that. We get great sponsorship from ZoomEd. Those guys are awesome to everybody in the herp community, and they really, outside of USARC, which half people don't realize they're doing that, but they sponsor herp societies like crazy all over the place.
Wow.
We get in great speakers. We have a great, because of ZoomEd, we had an amazing raffle last month. I think we had probably $2,000 worth of stuff on the table that went for a couple $100, but everybody that dropped a dollar seemed to walk away with, $5 worth of stuff when they walked away from the raffle. Things like that's amazing. But we also had a Junior Herb Society we just started that because our meetings are Wednesday nights, like 7 to 10, we just can't get kids in for that. So we started a Junior Herb Society. Now we got some young kids coming in, which will hopefully be the next generation. And we're trying to get in touch with some of the – Chicago's a weird place because we got the big city, South Side. There's stuff going on there that Sheltered White Boy America has no idea about. There's we had one group come into our big Reptile Fest event, and I was trying to, do something with USARC to promote, the benefits of reptiles with kids. And this group came in, and I was asking the guy, I'm like, well, what can you tell me? What are some benefits? He's like, well, listen, man, this group of kids, they're all in this because of the reptiles. And he does an outreach program with them. And he's like, they're all coming in to help me out because of the reptiles. I got a kid that won't go home out if it's after dark because he's so scared of his neighborhood. He'll sleep on my floor. He's graduating high school. He's the first kid in his family to graduate high school. Some of these kids are going to be the first kids to ever go to college. They get into this stuff, and they really – it sounds silly to you and I as hobbyists. And, if we're hobbyists, we got money, we got a job, we're able to afford all these toys, which is what the animals really are. These kids don't have any of that. And for them, it's like such a huge thing to have an outlet outside of the gangs.
Right.
And some of these kids, it's like I have to feed and give shirts to all these different people that come into my event that volunteer at our event. And I felt like an ass when I found out all the real life stuff going on with these people, because I was getting kind of annoyed that I had to feed 20 people at two tables. I'm like, why am I feeding that many people? I got one person working 17 tables. Why am I?
Right.
And I found out, all this other stuff. Well, here, give them some food. Crap, I feel like a jerk. But we're trying to reach out to those kind of people as well. Once I found out about this stuff, it really kind of reached a new passion in me. We can really help people out. And there's a whole world of things out there that we don't even average white America, or not even white, not just average non-inner city America has no clue about.
Right.
I have no idea about you can't cross a street or you get shot.
Right.
When does that ever happen? So we're trying to reach out to that kind of audience as well, to try to get people an opportunity, because, when you get kids into reptiles, they'll read everything.
Oh, yeah.
I just sent my nephew Kathy Love's book, and he just got it today, and he's already calling me up asking me about Punnett squares.
That's awesome.
It's a little early,
right? Yeah, he got his first snake 2 weeks ago, and I'm like, all right, cool. Let me hook you up. I'll send you a book. So I called up Kathy and said, hey, can you sign it? I really get a kick out of that. And he called me up to say, oh, she knew my name and she signed it, and that's amazing. I'm like, all right, that's cool. Just Kathy, but all right. He's thrilled, and he's like, so I get an albino, so if I get a snow, I can breed it. I can eat it. I'm like, yeah, you can do all that. And he's like, that's amazing. And, for some of the kids had for 3 hours to have that much understanding already, it's just amazing.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but when I first saw my first snake and had it in a cage and got to watch it, I don't think I left the sight of that cage for hours on end, just watching it. It was a garter snake, and just stared at it, you know, moving around the cage, and you get mesmerized about it. That's cool. That's awesome that you're doing that.
Yeah. Well, some of the kids that come to our show have, like, we had a kid, I walked over to my friend's table who had a bunch of amphibians. She has a thing called Frog Lady, she does, and she had a toad on her table, and there's this little kid staring at this toad just, like, enthralled. I was like, oh, you like the toad? He's like, he looked at me, and he had this really serious, like, cynical look on his face, and he kind of crossed his arms in front of his chest. He's like, is that real? I'm like, yeah, it's real. No,
yeah.
I mean, is that alive? I'm like, yeah. You've never seen a toad before? I'm like, holy
wow.
crap, that's a, you know. So the outreach things are huge. I mean, if you got a society, you got to get out there and do some outreach and try to touch some other people outside of the reptile world.
Sure. And that sets up the next generation for the hobby.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if you were going to start a society, what would be the number one tip you would give somebody that would want to do that? That's a huge undertaking.
There's no society in your area. Be prepared to just give up your free time in your life, as you really have to bust your butt to do it. There's a group on Facebook, and we're trying to get a website going. A couple years ago at Tinley, the idea popped up, and a few of us were talking about it, and we got a bunch of people together. Recently, we're trying to retool it a little bit to make it a little bit more towards the guys who are still involved with it. But it's called the National Herp Congress, and the purpose of it is to reach out to other societies, all societies across the country, and try to communicate
wow.
them back and forth. So if you're interested in starting a society anywhere in the country, if you contact us on Facebook, just look up National Herp Congress, National Herpological Congress, you can find us, ask questions. The guy who's the president right now, Ryan McVeigh, he started the Madison Area Herp Society, I think, 2 years ago or something, and he's put everything into it. He's put his all into it, and he's really doing a great job with it. He's the guy to ask how to start a society. And also Nate down in Arizona, he just started one as well. So there's been a few that have popped up in the last couple of years. The goal of the NHC is to be able to offer support to people that, you know, have questions. How do I do this? How do I get speakers? Who's a good speaker to bring in? How do I get people to my meetings? All those kind of things. And really the huge problem is, like, Tinley. I keep going back to Tinley, that's our local show. I go there, and I see all these people I know, all these local people there, and I go to our herd meeting, I don't see any of those people.
Right.
The only reason that Chicago doesn't have herp laws is because of the Chicago Herpological Society. The only reason we've had any influence is we go out and do all the shows for all the aldermen, which goes into Chicago politics, but aldermen are like little gods of their own little neighborhoods here. They have incredible power, and if they're on your side, they're not going to pass herp laws. Real simple.
Right.
We go out and we do their, you know, sidewalk festivals or whatever they have going on, and put in a presence where, you know, anytime you bring reptiles, you get a crowd that's happy. They get it for free. They turn around, they don't pass laws against us. That's great, but you need a society that's got the insurance that can go out there, because no politician is going to have you come out and do a show, or no intelligent politicians have you come out and do a show unless you have the insurance. So, you know, that's a big thing with societies. We have the insurance to cover all of our members at shows if there's ever a problem, and more so not the ghost problem that's never going to occur, hopefully, but the possibility of a problem that the politicians and whoever else are looking at, or whoever the show promoter is that they're looking at, they just want to have the insurance to cover that possible problem. So we're able to get out there and really get our feet on the ground with the right people and shake the right hands to keep anything from happening in this area. So it's great, except whenever we have a good herp law die like we just had this year, because we didn't have enough support. But if you don't have the societies doing it the right way, you're going to lose the politicians. If you lose the politicians, you lost the game.
Right.
Right.
That's how it works out.
Okay.
I would strongly suggest you guys get something going. I'm kind of somewhere between the old school and the new school, because our society's older than I am by probably 15 years or something, and we've got members who are still there when it started. I mean, Ray Pauley was one of our founding members here. They, at one point, allowed sales of animals, allowed before the internet, they had book sales, and that really drove membership way up. But it was people come in for the animal sales, and then you'd have people leave after they purchased their animals because they only came for the swap atmosphere. They don't want to hear a speaker, which to me is just mind-boggling. But that was the mentality, so we eliminated the sales. Like, we don't want that riffraff. I mean, I say we. This happened before I ever became a member. But you don't want that. And that'd be my only suggestion. You don't associate a sale with the meeting just for the simple fact that you're going to have people that have no interest in the meeting. And the worst thing in the world is not having nobody there for a speaker. The worst thing in the world is having people there, and as soon as the speaker starts to talk, they leave.
Right.
And that's what you get when you have sales at the show, at your society meetings.
Which is terrible.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
Because you're going to learn
so
much.
While you're leaving.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Chicago is, I do want to move back south at some point, and I would think I would want to start a society if there wasn't one wherever I moved to. I can't imagine doing it without the just the money and the society, all the things society has here between the money and the museum and everything, because we get these amazing speakers, and it's easy. You ask them, they're like, oh, yeah, okay, cool. I need to get up there anyway. All
right,
great.
Right.
Yeah. Wait for 5 minutes and you'll have all your answers.
Yeah. I mean, guys we get good, like Dante Finolio is one of our past speakers, or Mike Pingleton's another guy who, and Mike's not even professional herper, and like he's gone to school for years to be a, you know, some herp scientist type thing. He's just a dude that gets on the ground and gets out and busts his butt and gives a great presentation. He's a great presenter. And he's come up numerous times. And just that was one of my favorite things about going to one of the Midwest Herp Symposiums, is getting to hang out with Mike in the hotel room, looking at him go through a slideshow of a recent trip. And that's another
cool
thing is you get members, you guys talking about you have the Arboreal Symposium coming up, and there's the IHS coming up, and for the Midwest region, you got the Midwest Herp Symposium coming up. There's another symposium in Costa Rica is coming up. All these things are things people should be going to. And not for even the talks at the symposium, which can generally be amazing, but the camaraderie in the hotel room afterwards, and just hanging out with people and getting to sit down next to somebody that you're really never going to have a chance to sit down next to ever again outside of one of these symposiums, because they're not from your area and they're not in the same, you know, world you're in, and chat with them and learn stuff is amazing.
Yeah, I think like the Facebook thing or the forum or whatever, sometimes you type, I don't know about you guys, but me, I'm typing stuff and it gets taken out of context or it doesn't have the same, you know what I mean? And people, I don't know, when I'm talking to somebody, number one, they can feel my passion about something and how I feel about it, or I can feel that from somebody else and in turn fires me up about something. So, you know, I like the exactly what you're saying, the camaraderie of just hanging out with people and getting people's different ideas and takes on things and their experiences on keeping or breeding or, you know, field herping or whatever it would be, you know, and it's cool stuff. So
it's a, not to sound like condescending to herp shows or anything, but herp shows are filled with people trying to make money. Symposiums or herp societies, not necessarily the same thing. You'll get guys who want to make money anyways, and, you know, guys who are working an angle no matter where you go, but when you get to those, if someone's willing to sit through 6 hours of various talks, they're passionate. They care.
Yeah.
And you're not going to get, you might get the guy at the sale afterwards that's all about the money, but there's people there that, and that's their passion. And when you get a passionate person in front of you, you start talking to them, you can learn so much more than from a breeder.
Yeah.
I breed. I don't consider myself a breeder. I'm not making money. Never going to make money. I'm a terrible business person.
Well, at least you admit it.
Hand them a corn snake, they'll turn around and show you $10,000. It's like, how did you do that? You give me Boland's eggs hatching, and I'm not going to make any money.
Right.
Just not how I end up working it. Or if I do make money, I'll have a gigantic cage all of a sudden or something, but it's never going to be a profit. Give me in a room with a guy who's kept stuff forever and just has things that he's done that we don't even talk about doing anymore, never mind actually do, and you can get ideas and learn things from people. It's amazing.
Yeah, good stuff.
A lot of those symposiums, you pull in some old-timers that you just aren't going to see anywhere else. They don't go to shows because they don't care to buy anything anymore, but they've kept more things than you've ever even heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, I'm surprised sometimes. Actually, you learn some things when you're talking to people that maybe in the business or maybe they are breeding something different now, but years ago they may have worked with the species that you're working with.
Right.
I find that a lot with carpet pythons, like years ago, there's this breeder that, works with carpet pythons and doesn't anymore because they may work with, something that's more commercially viable, but still they have had experience with the species or scrubs look at the Barkers, they're a perfect example. They've worked with, every type of python, but they're known nowadays for their blood pythons or ball pythons and boa constrictors, and that's cool, but the knowledge that they have about other species of python or snakes just in general is just, I can't imagine having a conversation with them. It's just probably would be, the knowledge that those guys have, it's just crazy. But
yeah, well, the secret there is Tracy's the brains.
Oh, okay.
Oh, all right. Absolutely. Well, as long as we know that one, yeah.
Dave's great at talking, and he's a great presenter. Tracy's the brain. So if you want to know the real secret, go to ask Tracy, because Dave didn't pay attention or forgot or something, and Tracy, she's dead on.
Right.
Jesus.
That woman's amazing.
Yeah, I would agree. I've heard some of her other interviews that she's done, and she just is like the python whisperer, you would say, So
that's awesome.
Yeah, and she's not somebody you're going to see at the bar, after they tell her. She's back in her hotel room resting, putting her feet up.
Right, exactly.
You got to catch her someplace else.
Very cool.
Catch her at
the
show.
Great thing about the symposiums, too. Are you guys doing the after symposium hospitality room, hang out, get pizza and drink and stuff?
Oh, yeah, there's going to be an after party in the Morelia Python radio room. Eric doesn't know about it yet, but that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I'm bringing a cooler. No one's going to sleep. It's going to be fantastic.
I went to Tinley Park for the first time in, 2012, I guess it was, 20. The coolest part of that whole experience was hanging out afterwards, and I hung out with, we had all the cool carpet guys there. There was Chondro people there. It was just such a cool experience to hang out with that group of people from all over the U.S. and just talk to them about, nerd out about snakes, it was cool.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Text Owen random pictures of shit at 2 in the morning. He didn't come.
Yeah,
that was great. Let's do that again.
I ran the Midwest Herb Symposium in 2009, I think. I ran it the same weekend as Tinley, thinking I could get people to come over and then go back to Tinley on Sunday, and that didn't work out very well. Thankfully, there's a lot of people in the mid that are dedicated to the Midwest Herb Symposium. But one of the things about that I was, as I was taking over the reins, having never done it before, is you have a hospitality room and herpers like to drink.
Right.
I said, all right. And we had the entire tub filled, I think, three layers deep with different beers and you know, thumb sodas and fruit drinks for some of the people who've given up drinking over the years. And from Saturday night to Sunday morning, I think it was empty.
Wow.
That's amazing.
That's cool.
I mean, people brought their own stuff, but it, you know, people think, oh, the Herp Symposium, it's going to be a geek party. It's like, well, kind of. It's a party for geeks, but we had a good time.
Right.
But,
very cool.
And then, like, again, the stuff you get to learn at some of those things. We had a guy named Zoltan Takashin talking about why cobras are immune to their own venom, and ended up getting to hang out with him afterwards. The guy's been to like 100 countries, and he's kind of like Brian Fry, but off Facebook. He's not on Facebook talking to everybody, but he's just this guy has been everywhere, done everything, seen every snake, and that's just it was amazing. I'm like, hey, have you ever seen this? And like, I can name anything you can think of, any obscure, particularly if it was venomous, because he's a venom guy, but any obscure snake you can think of, he'd be like, oh, yeah, that's from this country, and yes, I did that. Mm-hmm, yeah, okay. Yeah, they're like this. And, like, no matter what it was, he had, like, some factoid about any animal you could think of. And it was just stunning to sit there and talk to this guy. And I've got my little microcosm of interest on different species. And he's like, oh, yeah, well, this and that and this and that. And yeah, that's okay. And then he's got turns around and talks to, like, 30 other people with all their different microcosms, and he knew everything about everything.
Oh, wow.
You just don't get guys like that, really.
Jesus. Not anymore. That's cool. It's awesome.
And I'm not even talking hobby species. I mean, like, stuff you'd never even heard of. He kept it, milked it, knows what the venom is in it, and figured out some cure for something with it. It was just a cool time.
That's insane.
Very
That's
cool.
Insane.
Yeah, I really hope you guys' symposium goes well. I can't make it. I really want to get out there. Need to add some more arboreal colubrids to that group.
Yeah, I think that it's going to be a really good time for the fact that people are going to see for a couple different things. But one, the people that will be there. You got guys like Trooper Walsh and Eugene Bissett, who've been breeding chondros and, you know, all this other arboreal snakes, that the knowledge that they have just to talk to them, just like what you're saying, is going to be awesome. Then you have the fact that you're going to, it's kind of tied in with speakers giving great talks, really, really cool stuff. You know, they really handpicked a really good group of people. And then you have, on top of that, you have a show where you're going to see species of snakes that, you know, you don't see every day at shows.
Yes.
Which excites me, you know. Because I don't know, man. There's just something about when you see a species for the first time. Yeah.
Something new. It catches your eye, and you want to know. So yeah.
Yeah, but you can. But when you see it in person, it's just.
Oh, that's the thing. It's yeah. You can look at a book all you freaking want. You can look at internet pictures, whatever. You can have it taken from the best picture in the best lighting from the best photographer. Nothing beats the real freaking thing. Like right now, I'm like, I like bolins. They're cool. I guarantee you, once Pitaro puts one in my freaking hands, I'm like, oh my God, sell everything. I need 20 of these things. I mean, like, that's what we're working on. I'm thinking we're going to go.
Bolins have one of the coolest heads I've ever seen on a snake. That it's like a bulldog or I don't know. It's just a. Yeah, there's something very remarkable about seeing them in person that I've never seen captured in a photo. The iridescence, I've seen people catch there, these amazing iridescent photos, and I've seen them in person. I'm like, oh, they're not really that iridescent. But the actual animal and the texture of it and the feel and the musculature is different. They're a very cool species. I just happened to help somebody move, and they're like, you got bolins? Oh, yeah, I got bolins. I did not know that. But,
big deal.
Just happened to, like, walk into the right room at the right time. Her take on it was they're a messy, big black snake, and they're not very exciting. Are you kidding me?
Oh,
they're amazing.
Wow.
whatever. Yeah, getting to see stuff in person is amazing. If you guys come out back up to Tinley, stop by my table for sure. I'm gonna, depending on whether I get outer ring or inner ring, you get more space in the inner area, but it costs you more money.
Right.
If I do the inner area, though, I'm going to bring some Soosties out and some Spilotes, and those are just animals you have to see in person and really get a feel for the intelligence of them and the activity and the movement. They're just. I went to Peru and saw the first time I ever saw a Soosties sulphurus. It was a giant 9-foot puppy dog that was as big around as a soda can, and it just. I was in awe, and I'm like, I have to get one of these. It took me like 4 years to find somebody captive breeding them, and I was thinking I was going to be the first guy to captive breed them in the U.S., and like everything in this hobby, you're not the first. Someone's already done it.
Damn.
Somebody's doing it right now. But it's still awesome that there's so few people, and now people know that I have them. I'm just constantly posting pictures that I'm just enthralled with these things, just constantly loving them, and it's a legitimate, true, just passion I have for them, and people get that in the photos and the way I talk about them, and there's people that are just excited, and like, oh my God, produce them, I'll buy them, how much, take my money.
Shut up and take my money.
Yeah, and I love that, you know, I started a group on Facebook called Arboreal Colubrids just for the people like me who kept oddball stuff, whether it's Asian rats or, I mean, it's not even all arboreal. We got people who do creepos and some of the gophers and waters and garters, but stuff that, like, all the stuff that you don't see at shows anymore that used to be there that people just, they weren't making money, so they disappeared.
Right.
And these are people who are just like, I don't care about the money. These are just awesome animals. I love this garter snake. Like, well, freaking cool. I love that you love that garter snake.
Yeah. That's
truly,
how I feel.
There's nothing more. There's nothing more exciting than finding somebody that's passionate about an animal, and you don't have to ask them why they're passionate because they're shoving it in your face. They're like, look at this. This is amazing. Look at this.
You think you like
this?
They
do this and that.
Hit me with it. Yeah. So.
Right.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Very, very cool. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, if you guys come by Tinley, definitely check me out. I'll
I have to.
I'll make you want some Soosties.
I can't do it this time because I'm being Alaska this Tinley, which I keep planning this shit wrong. So
I'll be at Tinley.
Here's your lack of excuse for next year. They've already got the 2014 spring show dates, and by the time the spring show rolls, they'll have the fall dates. So you're like 9 months away from having an excuse.
Right.
I know I don't have excuses. Stop pointing it out to people.
He will still screw it up, though. Don't worry. He will still screw it up.
Yeah.
It's not like it's in the same month every year. It's not like, you know, it's the same time every year. So, I mean.
All right.
Hey, it is.
I got it. That's
your loss, Owen. Your loss. It's a good experience.
I promise I'll make the spring show. I promise. If I have to just hide in the back of Eric's car.
Very
you know,
cool.
This year because it was our 20th Reptile Fest, 20th annual Reptile Fest. I didn't have anybody to work our Herp Society table. I didn't pull a table for the Spring Tinley, but the Spring Tinley people just killed that. The vendors are just stunning, man. They were just everybody sold out. It was amazing. Like I was outside just working basically an exhibit table and trying to talk to people about our show coming up, and I'd walk in there and they're like, hey, didn't you just have like 20 snakes on your table? He's like, yeah. You go to the next guy, and like a couple guys sold out completely. It was amazing. I think there was so much and so many people went to the fall show that the follow-up for the spring show was the people still showed, but there was like a third of the vendors or half the vendors.
Right.
Which, if you went to the fall show, it was not, that's not a very small amount of vendors. There's still a ton of vendors.
Yes.
But the people were still there in mass. So like the spring show, people killed. It was amazing.
Yeah.
You know, Tinley was the first show that I ever vended. So when you come off of that kind of caliber of a show and then you go to like something like Hamburg, you're kind of like ruined because you know It's just, I don't know.
Yeah.
You'll see, Owen.
Yeah.
It's just
the bingo
like,
hall doesn't work anymore.
Oh, dude,
yeah,
if I had
just
to listen to you one more time go, this isn't like Tinley, I was going to smack you, okay?
It's ridiculous.
It's
kind of like if somebody gave you, a Sunburst 1956 Gibson Les Paul as your first guitar, and you plug it in and you're jamming away, and then they're like, well, here's this, like, Ibanez guitar over here for you. It's pretty cool, and, it does this, but you're like, no, I don't think so. You're just spoiled for the whole experience. I don't know. It's definitely it's a cool – what other shows do you vent? Any other ones, or is that the main one that you go to?
It's a Sewer Fest in Wisconsin, just because it's my buddies, and it's a Captive Bread only show.
Okay.
The fact that they actively enforce the Captive Bread only aspect of the show.
That's awesome.
I will buy a table, whether I got something to sell or not, just to support them every year. You know, they run it twice a year, and it's like $30 or $40 a table, and it's, to me, just to support that integrity is worth it, whether I have a dime I'm going to make off it or not. Plus, they give all their vendors free beer, so.
Oh, my God.
where
is this show? Can we do this show?
It's up in Wisconsin. It's definitely worth checking out. Like I said, just the fact that they're actively enforcing Catherine only, and they've come over. It's a gecko guy and a guy mostly in pet stores, so he knows the pet store animals, and the other guy knows the geckos, and he knows some lizards and stuff, but they don't know snakes per se. What's actually Catherine-born and stuff. So they walked over and asked me, hey, is that Catherine-born? Have you ever seen anybody produce that? No. All right, cool. Walk over. They get off the table. What? No, Catherine-born. No, too bad. No, get off the table. Like, holy crap,
wow.
That's awesome.
That's insane.
Daytona supposedly is Captive Bread only, and Tinley, at least, they don't claim to be Captive Bread only. They say they're strongly Captive Bread and only allow healthy, strong, farm-raised or whatever. There's some wording they have on it. They say, it's got to be quality stuff, so you can't bring in crap. But there's nobody really that does Captive Bread only that actually enforces it other than these guys I've ever seen. So.
Awesome.
Like I said, for $40, I'll be there every year.
That's it.
As long as I got the ability to make it there just to
hang
out, drink beer, and whatever else.
Sure.
They feed us, too, if I remember right. They give you get a Wisconsin brat.
For $40. Wow.
That's awesome.
Can't beat that.
Yeah. No.
We're just about out of time, and we're in recording now. So I mean, we went over live 17 minutes ago. So if somebody wants to get in contact with you, do you got an email or do you Facebook or what's the best way?
Facebook's probably the most realistic way. I got a website, snakesunlimited.com, but I saw you before. It's not really updated, and there's an email on there. I eventually do check it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Like I said, I'm not in this for the money. I'm not looking to make millions or anything. It's a passion and it's a hobby and it's something I really enjoy doing. So, I get out there and do the shows and meet people in person and people on Facebook who know me. That's who I usually end up selling to.
Gotcha.
But
okay.
I'm always happy to meet new people and do new things. It's just not my 100% main goal in the world is try to make some bills.
Right.
Cool. That's
fine. Cool.
That's everybody's goal, but
yeah.
I think that if you're passionate about a species or about anything, really, people just tend to be drawn to that, and you become successful because you just believe in something. That's just been my life lesson, I guess you would say, I don't know.
Yeah.
It just seems like the guys that are into that, they just draw people to them,
I get friends in the hobby that, if there's ever, and when I say friends, I mean people I've sold stuff to.
Right.
Not that I've ever sat down and had a drink with them or anything else. I don't know them anywhere off of online. But I've seen, people try to talk crap about me, and They just go at them. It's like, I don't have to defend myself. You get your ass kicked by her. But and that's, I think that's really a cool sign of respect that you got people that will fight your fight without you ever even knowing there's a fight to happen.
Right.
You know, they respect mm-hmm. you enough to say there's no way in hell that's what happened. And that's, you know, if nothing else, if you can have that kind of reputation in the hobby, that's, I think, you did something right.
That's pretty cool.
Nice.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on, Jason. It's been great talking to you. And, welcome back anytime.
This time.
So.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate it. And I really apologize for spacing on you guys last month.
That
no worries.
I space on us all the time. Eric has to call me from where are you supposed to be?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Yeah. So it's okay.
I was sitting here playing video games, just vegging out. I had a terrible day at work, and I was 3 inches from my phone. It was probably laying against my leg. It wasn't like I was busy or anything. I just completely spaced, and that sucks, and I apologize for that.
Fine. No worries.
Yeah.
No.
But I kicked some ass in Skyrim. So.
Well, that's all that matters.
There you go.
Yeah. I kill stuff, so.
Good.
All right, guys, I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you guys, and really good luck on the symposium. I hope you guys get some people out there.
Yeah, hopefully. And we'll definitely come out and see you when we come to Tinley, all right?
Absolutely, guys. Thanks.
All right, thanks a lot.
Have a good night.
You too. There we go. Very cool show. Very cool stuff that we discussed. We hit on some of the morph talk with the whole morph subject that's up with the whole getting into something that you dig and being passionate about it. And people will just, be drawn to you. And don't be too many sheep, man. Too many sheep. Not enough shepherds. You know, it's my way of looking at things, man. Do what you love. Do what you're passionate about. You got to clean up snake shit.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure it's the snake that you like, man. Don't do it because people, it's going to sell or, you know.
Right.
Not everybody's going to like carpet pythons, but that doesn't stop
me.
Not everybody's going to like scrub pythons. I don't give a shit. I love them, you know. It's just the way it is. I just, there's nothing that makes me more excited about learning things than anything Morelia. I don't know why. I don't know what about that group of snakes that I just love. I don't know what it is. But when I have another snake, they're cool. I dig them. I like talking to people about what they like, and I can appreciate all that. But for me personally, that's the end all be all of snakes. But enough of that, you know, but we'll be talking about, go ahead.
I'm saying, I've been bad on Facebook. You were distracted and then I did horrible things. So
what did you do?
Well, someone in this conversation posted up that I am dreamy on Buddy Buscemi's post of Rogue Reptiles. And I kind of went a little sideways with the post. Underneath it, it says, not here, Eric. People can see the comments on here. And, of course, then Balin took it and ran, and now it's gone awry.
No, it's just trouble. Okay, I'm going to have to look it up.
you left me alone. You weren't watching me. That's what this is.
Oh,
what
man.
Happens here. Yeah,
I can't take this anywhere. Jesus Christ.
Nope.
We're
right away.
Bring,
restraints.
Yeah.
I just kept going into the chair again. Yeah. I'm already playing things.
Dip this in his drink right here, and he'll be out. I can hear it now. Your chondro sucks. Oh, great! Here we go.
Oh, here it goes. Yeah. I was like, I don't know. I'm kind of tempted to get Eric a little tipsy and then be like, so what do you think about the morph debate? And then just watch you go crazy.
Oh, geez. No.
So if we had to pay a little extra. Eric broke the hotel room over the morph debate. Like, you know, it's just this goddamn snake in a box. Heave a chair. It's like, oh, whoa.
That's my passion,
easy
man.
Easy there, buddy.
I know.
I know.
Don't start me, man. Don't start me. I can't. I feel it. It's brewing up. It's brewing up.
I know, and I love it. I can push the buttons and then run away.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, exactly. Oh,
that's
man.
My plan. Christ.
Control, control, control.
I know, I know. You're going to have to because I can't. I have no control.
Yeah.
You're the level-headed one out of us. You can't lose
yeah.
control. What the hell I look like? So.
Very good. So I guess we'll just give the quick synopsis of what we got, and we'll go call it a night. My closings, I got the forum, www.moreliapythons.com, proud sponsor of the show, very cool forum, go check it out. And we are proud sponsors of ICAST, the International Collective Arboreal Symposium. That's coming up August 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. The registration ends on the 24th, so and I hopefully I got this right, but the registration basically entitles you to the lunch on Saturday and the T-shirt. After that, you don't get that anymore. So if you are interested in that, make sure you go and register. If you're sitting on the fence, listen to any of the shows with any of the people that we've had that comes down to talking about ICAST, and if we don't, if we haven't convinced you at this point, then you know maybe you shouldn't come.
You know
what I mean?
Yeah, we don't want you to come. Yeah.
You know, I just don't know how else to put it. You know, you talk about passion. I don't think that there's a more passionate guy when it comes to chondros or the reptile community or Morelia than our good friend Buddy Buscemi.
Yes.
I love listening to that guy. He's just an awesome, awesome reptile keeper. He's one of those guys, you know, when we talked to him and he was talking about chondros, never knew that he kept carpets, never knew that he kept Antaresia. You know, he's worked with multiple different types of species and, you know, just a really, really cool guy. And you get to hang out and talk with him here. I mean, he's going to be there. You're going to be able to talk chondros with him, or you can even talk other species with him because he's been to both Carpet Fest. And when he comes, he's one of those guys that just captivate a room, man. I mean, you just listen to his every word, at least I do. And super smart, you know, just awesome stuff. Another guy like that was Ben from Australian Addictions. He's going to be there, and he's another guy, man. You
yes.
just listen to him, and just his thought process on questions that you ask him is just blows me away. But
yeah, Ben is just a wealth of information, and it's just ridiculous. And then of course
yeah.
we have our other friends, which are like Balin, who's been breeding for how many years, Howard, who's always good for a laugh, Mo, who has the intense yellow of the sun harnessed into a snake scale. So yeah
so it's gonna be a good time. So yep,
it
go over there.
I can't freaking wait. Is it time yet?
Yeah, right. www.arboreal symposium.com and register up. As far as us, www.moreliapythonradio.com. Go over there. You can check it out. You can listen to the episodes. It's linked there. You can check out our Facebook page. Me and Owen are there. All
yep.
of our info. We got the Morelia Tip of the Week. You know, different, just a lot of cool stuff all there. Links you to everything that we talk about, different news and all kinds of stuff. If you want to follow the news, what I try to do during the week, just if people don't realize, if you don't go over and like Morelia Python Radio Facebook page, I try to just see the cool things that I see in the world of Morelia or sometimes Australian pythons or maybe just even reptiles in general. And I try to put little links up there to different things of what's going on so that when we talk about it on the show, you can kind of put a picture or a video or a face or whatever with
you
what
know
we're
what we're talking about.
About.
Yeah.
Exactly. So
yeah.
Definitely go over there and like the page so you can find out what's going on. You can also download us on iTunes. Don't forget about that if you're wondering how you can listen to the show. iTunes is probably the easiest way. You can also follow us on Blog Talk Radio, and that's just blogtalkradio.com/MoreliaPythonRadio. And I guess the only other thing that I have is myself, ebmorelia.com. And that's all I got. What do you got, Owen?
Cool. What I got is you can definitely go to rogue-reptiles. Check us out over there. All the latest babies that are up for sale will be up there very soon. Until then, you can go to Rogue Reptiles on Facebook.com. You can get the latest updates on all the animals that we have currently for sale, as well as our breeders, as well as the plans for the 2014 season should be up momentarily. We're getting those set ready to go. Also, you can go and follow Rogue Reptiles on Twitter, which is Rogue_Reptiles at Twitter. We have a show coming up on the 27th up in Reading, Pennsylvania. If you're in the area, please, please, please come by. We always enjoy talking with everybody. We'll be splitting the table with my good friend Andrew from Squamata Unlimited. He's going to be bringing some of his monitors. If you've never seen some big, big, big healthy monitors in person, you're going to want to check these guys out. You saw them yesterday, Eric, and monsters. So it's definitely a good show to go to. Come by, say hi, talk some snakes.
Absolutely.
That's pretty much all I got. So what we'll say is thank you again for coming by and listening to some Morelia Python Radio. We will catch you all next week. Good night.